Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
Move to another topic now, one that also touches on guns. The statistics show that a majority of gun deaths in America are actually suicides. And for the past year, many experts and lay people alike have worried that the mental health stresses of the pandemic, isolation, job loss, lockdowns, the constant reminders about sickness and death, could lead to an increase in suicides. And while scientists are still combing through the data, the early findings suggest that might not have been the case. Except for one group, African Americans. According to one alarming recent study, focusing on just one state during the first weeks of the lockdown, but alarming nonetheless, suicide mortality among African Americans nearly doubled, while decreasing substantially among white residents. We wanted to learn more about this study, which focused on Maryland, so we called one of the co-authors. Dr. Paul Nestat is assistant professor of psychiatry at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore and a researcher who studies suicide. And before we continue, let me note that we know that this is a topic that may be upsetting to some. So if that's the case, we invite you to step away for a few minutes and we'll be happy to welcome you back later on. Having said that, Dr. Nestat, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
So let's get all the sort of the disclaimers and the metrics and the caveats out there. Again, the study focused just on data from Maryland, and you compare data from three distinct periods pre-COVID, while closures were happening, and then while reopening was happening, and you compared this information to the same periods in previous years. Do I have that right?
That's absolutely right.
So let me just read from the paper. Among black residents, suicide mortality appeared to double during period two compared with the means in 2017 to 2019. In contrast, suicide mortality appeared nearly halved among white residents during period two and three compared with the means of 2017 to 2019. And you point out that the population didn't change substantially between 2017 to 2019. So this would be, that's a significant change.
Yeah, it's very significant. It actually was surprising in a couple of different ways. For one, as you mentioned, many experts thought that suicides in general were going to go up a lot during the pandemic because of all of those stressors that you listed at the beginning of the show. We didn't see that happen in aggregate. But when we disaggregated the data, as you said, during that, I guess we can call it now the first wave of COVID in Maryland and the United States in general, there was this incredible doubling of the suicide numbers in African Americans here.
What made you want to look at this? As you point out in the piece, that to your knowledge, this is the first to characterize suicide trends by race and ethnicity during COVID-19. What made you take a look at this?
Well, part of it is knowing that even if there is an aggregate decrease in suicide during COVID, as we are starting to see in Maryland, there are vulnerable populations that were hit more by COVID than others. We know that Black Marylanders had higher rates of COVID infection. This is the case nationwide as well. And also, once infected, higher case fatality rates. So basically, this pandemic hit Black Marylanders a lot harder than white Marylanders. So there was reason to believe that there might be more distress, and suicide has traditionally been a marker of distress in our data.
But why do you think that is, though, given that I think your study indicates that suicide is more common generally among the white population? Is that accurate?
That's true. That's true. About nationwide, a majority of suicides are white. White Americans have a higher rate of suicide than Black Americans in general.
And in Maryland as well.
And in Maryland as well.
So this is a significant change. Do you have a theory about why that is?
Yeah, well, you know, we can make a lot of assumptions. I have some theories. I think part of it, as I mentioned, Black Marylanders were hit harder by the pandemic. They might have had less of an economic cushion to withstand things like job loss or less ability to draw on resources for things like childcare. And there's no way to know for sure with these particular suicides if the pandemic played a role. But the correlation to the increase in infections and deaths and the suicide rate is hard to ignore. It might also be an issue of access to care. We know that Black Americans in general, and Black Marylanders are no exception, have more difficulty accessing care, have a higher likelihood of not having insurance, and that applies to mental health care as well. So having the ability to reach out and get help when you need help is really important, and that's something that we can prioritize and make sure there are resources available for everyone that needs psychiatric help when needed.
I am going to make an assertion here which you may or may not agree with, but I'm going to make an assertion here that I think we don't often see African Americans as people who are vulnerable to suicide. And I wonder if you feel that this study amplifies our understanding of this as a significant concern.
I absolutely think that you're correct. Because the majority of suicides have been among white Americans, there's been too little focus on suicides among people of color. We have had a relatively good history of looking at suicide in Native American, American Indian populations, because there's high rates there as well. But specifically Black Americans, the rates have been going up faster than they have in white Americans. But we're recognizing more and more that risk for suicide is up there and increasing for Black Americans, especially younger Black males. In the white population, we see suicides more in middle age and sort of very old, like after 85. But the risk period is highest for Black Americans around age 20. And that's arguably much more tragic to lose someone so young.
Dr. Paul Nestat is assistant professor of psychiatry at Johns Hopkins University. He's one of the co-authors of a recent study on suicide mortality in Maryland during the early weeks of the coronavirus pandemic. The study is published in the April 2021 issue of JAMA Psychiatry. Dr. Nestat, thanks so much for talking to us today.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
South Africa reports an unexpected side effect from an effort to fight the pandemic. The country banned alcohol sales. Prohibition was an effort to keep people from gathering and spreading coronavirus. Here's the side effect. Emergency rooms suddenly became a lot less busy with alcohol-related injuries. So far, so good. But there was a side effect to the side effect, a serious drop in some people's business. NPR's Ida Peralta. Ada Peralta peels back the layers of a story that tells you a lot about South Africa's history.
The alcohol bans in South Africa have been draconian. You couldn't sit at a bar, you couldn't order a glass of wine, you couldn't even buy beer at the store. So last month, as South Africa lifted the ban, people flooded into bars. At noon on a weekday, there are already a dozen people at the premium sports bar here in Cape Town. Wellington Tobela was drinking a pitcher of beer with his friends.
That is why now we are all together here. We're now starting to enjoy this new life.
The bans were not popular with many South Africans. Tobela says it felt like collective punishment, even against people like him, who just wanted a drink after a long overnight shift.
We are not abusing the booze. We use the booze as something, as a material that can entertain us.
The South African government banned alcohol just as the world locked down last year. They were trying to keep people from gathering. Plus, sober South Africans were less likely to violently protest a complete lockdown. But this is a country with a huge alcohol industry that employs almost 300,000 people. The Western Cape produces some of the finest wine in the world, and South Africans are some of the most ardent alcohol consumers on the continent. William Goliath, who owns this bar and the liquor store next door, says the ban nearly killed his business.
No, to be honest, there was moments that we thought one of the businesses is going to have to go, we're going to have to put it up for sale or for something because things were not good.
His bar is in Mitchell's Plain, a township created by the apartheid government for colored people. At the time, people of color were kept out of most businesses. Black people weren't allowed to drink or sell alcohol. Yet, in an act of rebellion, many turned their homes into shebeens, apartheid-era speakeasies. That's how this bar started. As a kid, Goliath remembers patrons drinking in his living room at all hours.
We were working from an early age. We had to clean up behind people, pick up glasses, mop the floors, things like that.
With the money they made at the bar, his parents could afford to send Goliath and his siblings to school. Eventually, Goliath took over the business. He legalized it and built this mega sports bar that employs dozens of people in a tough neighborhood. He saw the news about how the alcohol ban cleared emergency rooms, but he still wasn't convinced.
I won't say South Africans have a drinking problem. South Africans could possibly have a discipline problem.
The facts are different. doctors know alcohol and violence are intimately related.
Late on a Saturday evening, you could smell a combination of the blood and the alcohol. And that's the reality of working in a busy emergency unit in South Africa.
That's Dr. Melvin Moodley, who works for the Cape Town Health Department. Every weekend, he says, emergency rooms fill up with drunk people who have gotten into fights and ended up stabbed or shot. But things changed when South Africa banned alcohol.
We saw a dramatic drop in hospitalizations, but more specifically, we saw a dramatic drop in trauma-related hospitalizations.
That trickled down to every aspect of the health system. There were fewer people at the ER, fewer ICU admissions.
And the system just decompresses and more beds open up for COVID-19 patients.
Dr. Muzamil Ismail, who also works at the health department, says the ban saved lives. On New Year's Eve, a day notorious for its carnage, emergency rooms were completely empty. It was a reality check for South Africans.
It sort of removed the band-aid and it showed the wound for what it is, and everybody saw it. And we are now in a state of acknowledging that this is a problem.
Parliament has begun talking about whether changes are needed in South Africa's liberal booze policy. There is talk of raising the drinking age to 21, of banning advertising, and lawmakers have drafted a bill making it illegal to have even a single drink before driving.
They can come in here.
Back at Mitchell's Plain, Magda Rowe gives me a tour of the liquor store that takes up the front of her house. She has beer fridges, a cabinet with expensive gin and vodka.
You have everything?
Everything, yes.
She and her husband started selling booze illegally out of the back of their car. But over the years, it grew into a business, and it let her raise her kids with dignity.
You buy a bread from that money. And if you don't sell a beer today, there's no bread on the table. And it keeps us, like, going.
She goes back to her living room, where she's joined by Alan Samuels, the head of the Liquor Association, and Lynn Phillips, a community activist. This is a troubled neighborhood. Kids are killed by gunfire. Gangs are ubiquitous. Almost half the population is unemployed.
The people will always blame the alcohol, and I don't think it's the alcohol.
Phillips, the community activist, gently disagrees. Booze is tearing this community apart, but the relationship with alcohol here is complicated.
Our people were paid not a salary, but they were paid alcohol as a remuneration for the work that they've done.
Back in the apartheid days, it was known as the tot system. Black and colored workers at wine farms were given alcohol instead of a paycheck. It created a dysfunctional relationship with alcohol that Phillips says persists today. Alcohol, she says, is damaging. Yet at the same time, liquor businesses give people like Roe a chance at a better life. I ask Roe if this dilemma makes her want to change careers. She demurs and lets Samuels, the chair of the Liquor Association, answer for her.
That is basically the only thing that some of our people know is to sell liquor. Selling of the liquor, it is in you, it's in your veins.
That, he says, won't change. Ban or no ban. Ada Peralta, NPR News, Cape Town. Rugged like Rwanda, don't wander far or get shot the quick the rust of spotlight, baby. Rugged like Rwanda, don't wander far or get shot the quick the rust of spotlight. Rugged like Rwanda, don't wander far or get shot the quick the rust of spotlight, baby. You're in get mocked up. Attacks that spray your hall with rap ever saw.
The Rwandan genocide began 27 years ago today. Nearly a million Tutsis and moderate Hutus were slaughtered by Hutu militias spurred on by a racist criminal regime. Allegations that France was complicit have poisoned relations with Rwanda ever since. Now France is officially examining its role in the humanitarian disaster. NPR's Eleanor Beardsley reports.
15 French historians have spent the last 2 years poring over government archives, diplomatic cables, and military files. Their conclusion? France was not directly complicit in Rwanda's mass killings, but French authorities supported the violent and extremist Rwandan government, were blind to its preparations for the massacre, and reacted too slowly to stop the genocide. The historians say France therefore bears overwhelming responsibility for the Rwandan tragedy. Historian Vincent Duclair led the commission.
La France ne comprend rien, alors même qu'il y a un massacre qui est organisé.
France did not understand at all. These were organized massacres with calls to kill on the radio and buses transporting militias. This was not inter-ethnic violence, as we called it. It was planned genocide.
The report is particularly damning for former French President François Mitterrand, who saw France as competing with Anglo-American influence in Africa. Mitterrand considered Rwanda's Hutu President Juvenal Habyarimana a great Francophone friend and ally. For France, the enemy was the Rwandan Patriotic Front, the Tutsi group in exile in neighboring Anglophone Uganda, led by Paul Kagame, who is Rwanda's president today. Vincent Hugeux is a professor, writer, and journalist. He spent 13 years as Africa editor at L'Express magazine and was on the ground in Rwanda.
It was one of the most traumatic professional experiences I had.
Hugeux says the report exposes Mitterrand's blind and systematic support for a racist, corrupt, and violent Rwandan regime.
Why? Because of the linguistic obsession. In the mind of Mitterrand, who was at the time a man of the past, Rwanda was perceived as one of the last threatened outposts against the Anglo-Saxon conquest. It might sound, simplistic, even ridiculous, but it's true.
The genocide began after Habyarimana's plane was shot down by unknown forces in April 1994. French troops arrived 2 months later under a UN mandate to stop the genocide. Retired French Brigadier General Patrice Sartre commanded part of that force. He says even then his government's orders were inappropriate and led to tragic mistakes.
When we arrived in Rwanda, around 10,000 Tutsis were still resisting in the Bisesero Mountains in the western part of Rwanda. But because of a wrong assessment of the situation and because of inappropriate orders, we intervened only 3 days later when only 1,000 or 2,000 Tutsis were still alive.
The report says President Mitterrand and his coterie of like-minded advisors ignored warnings from French diplomats and military officials in Rwanda and pressed on with their own policy.
Merci à vous.
Merci.
Merci.
Franco-Rwandan couple Alain and Defroza Gauthier tracked down Rwandan war criminals. Defroza says many killers are still living freely in France.
Il est positif parce que il montre clairement la responsabilité de la France.
The report is positive because it shows the responsibility of France, and especially Mitterrand and his close advisors. It's very important for French public opinion that the French people know what they did.
President Emmanuel Macron's decision to commission the report and open the archives to the public are an effort to improve relations with Rwanda. The Rwandan government has called the report a step forward, and Macron is said to be planning a trip to Kigali next month. Eleanor Beardsley, NPR News, Paris.
The food was terrible, I guess.
Oh, my goodness. They got this liver surprise thing there. The liver surprise. They're really trying to pump that gel on the gel menu. I think they're trying to get that to go prime time. They're trying to get it to throw it in rotation. I was like, we just had this yesterday. I liked it already. God damn.
No tater tots?
No tater. You crazy? Tater tots? To get baked potatoes with a huge finger imprint on it.
All right.
Don't, you don't want to get me started. Jello, hair all in the mold. Like, damn, man, how you gonna mess up Jello? Jello is so wholesome and family-like, it just ruins it for me.
Well, to have a hair in there, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I'm like, come on, Bill Cosby pumps this, man.
Okay.
The hair, Jello. And then you can't go, excuse me, there's a hair in my Jello. I like to send
it. I like it different.
To the cook. Can I see the cook, please? You know, the cook is a big dude there, Bubba Joe.
Now, here's a startling statistic. People behind bars are 6 times more likely to experience food poisoning than those on the outside. That's because in many facilities, the budget for feeding people is as low as just $3 a day. That's a $1 breakfast, a $1 lunch, and a $1 dinner. When costs are that low, health and nutrition suffer, but it allows the private companies that contract with prisons and jails to provide meals in a way that makes them very profitable. The sector generates $4 billion in annual revenues And in many cases, they make even more money operating the commissary stores that people turn to in lieu of the institutional meals. With me now to talk more about this topic are Bianca Tylek, Executive Director of the advocacy group Worth Rises, and Leslie Sobel, a research fellow for the Food in Prison Project and lead author of the recent report by Impact Justice called Eating Behind Bars, Ending the Hidden Punishment of Food in Prison. And as many of you know by now, this segment is part of our series in partnership with the Green Space and Worth Rises about the business side of the prison industry. We have these conversations Mondays to preview a Tuesday Green Space panel on the same topic. They happen at 7 p.m. on Tuesdays, and you can sign up for tomorrow's or any of them by going to thegreenspace.org. Okay. Hi, Bianca. Welcome back. And Leslie, welcome to WNYC.
Thank you so much.
Hi, Brian. Nice to hear you again.
So, Leslie, currently, as I understand it, corporations that contract to provide meals for incarcerated people like to keep their costs down to about a dollar a meal per person. Can you walk us through a typical breakfast, lunch, dinner scenario on $3 a day?
Sure, and often it's actually less than $3 a day. The meals vary somewhat around the country, but a typical breakfast might include some biscuits with a few pats of margarine, maybe some oatmeal, some milk, maybe a piece of fruit. A typical lunch would be a sandwich on white bread with maybe some sort of lunch meat, or perhaps some iceberg lettuce posing as a salad, maybe a scoop of undercooked beans. Dinner could be something like a processed meat patty and a gravy over noodles with maybe some canned green beans, some more slices of white bread with margarine, and a big square of yellow cake. Many facilities also serve a fortified powdered beverage mix with all their meals. It's kind of like a Kool-Aid with added vitamins and minerals that's meant to ensure that the meals comply with an agency's nutritional requirements. But we heard from so many people who've been incarcerated that those mixes had such an awful chemical taste that they didn't actually drink them. And several people told us they were more likely to actually use those as hair dye instead. Yeah. So in general, these cheap meals are really high in sodium, high in sugar, very high in refined carbohydrates, and low in things like fruits and vegetables and quality protein. So it's basically the diet that we've all been told to avoid.
Bianca, many people may not know that there was actually a Supreme Court ruling on this topic in 1978 in a case called Hutto versus Finney that had to do with food in prisons and jails. You want to tell us about that case and what it changed?
Yeah, absolutely. So the case back in 1978 was actually one of the first cases that determined that it was cruel and unusual punishment to use food in prisons essentially as a weapon or a method of torture. At the time, many prisons and jails would serve something called gruel, which was essentially just like a meal. And I mean meal, not as in a meal, breakfast, lunch, and dinner, but a meal of products that were put into like a loaf and served. And at that time, and at times they even had worse off things like people subsisting on bread and just water for quite some time. And so Hutto versus Finney actually determined that people in prison had a constitutional right to food. And the idea that that even was necessary is pretty appalling, yeah. But nevertheless. And that, you know, serving people anything that was substandard to a calorie-sufficient diet was cruel and unusual punishment. Unfortunately, over the years, I think based on, you know, what we just heard from Leslie, we've seen that they've still found many, many ways around serving calorie-sufficient diets by trying these artificial things in drinks and things of that sort. So unfortunately, it did, one of the things that it did do, though, is that encouraged the privatization of food. So it actually brought in all these food service providers from the outside that said, oh, we can provide food at an institutional scale at a lower cost and actually promise that quality. Unfortunately, that just never happened.
Interesting. So, Leslie, on the health concerns when eating meals that are so cheaply prepared, has this been measured? Can you say with confidence based on any data what some of the health effects have been sort of population-wide among people incarcerated because of the food service industry?
So the most immediate effect is hunger. We did a nationwide survey of people who had been incarcerated, and 94% of people told us that they did not have enough food during their incarceration to feel full. People told us that the portions were about the same size as you'd see in an elementary school cafeteria for grown men and women. And at the same time, so much of the food is inedible, so people aren't even actually eating it. And in terms of the longer term impacts on physical health, prison food can cause or exacerbate diet-related diseases like diabetes, hypertension, heart problems. It can weaken the immune system, leaving people more susceptible to infectious diseases like COVID. We heard from people who are suffering long-term health effects like ulcers and gallstones and anemia and damage to their bones from not enough calcium, ongoing struggles to maintain a healthy weight. And food doesn't just impact physical health. There's actually research that shows that a diet low in certain critical nutrients can cause mental health issues ranging from things like depression and brain fog to impaired decision-making and aggressive and violent behavior. And there's also research that makes connections between things like food and trauma and food and substance use. And the typical prison diet is actually more likely to perpetuate a cycle of poor coping skills and health issues when it comes to things like trauma and substance use than it is to actually help it. 95% of people who are incarcerated will eventually be released. And the diet that is currently served in most facilities is pretty much ensuring that people are going to be released in worse physical and mental health than they went in, which is impacting not only those individuals, but also their families and their communities.
Let's take a phone call. AJ in Queens, you're on WNYC. Thanks so much for calling in. Hi, AJ.
Hey, good morning. How are you?
Good. You got a story for us, I see.
I was incarcerated for 27 years, and I've been home almost 12 years. And I must say that the diet that we had was definitely something that contributed to a lot of medical conditions that I've experienced. In fact, when I came home, I had a stomach disorder, and not to mention, as far as our diabetes and things is concerned, we would supplement our meals with the commissary, but the commissary was high in sodium and sugar. So what would happen is we'd end up with hypertension, and our sugar levels would be off the rack because we needed to try and do something to give some type of form of nutrition. But as a result of the food that was provided to us, it didn't give us much of the nutrition. In fact, even the juice that they was given, many of us from a long time ago, we had the feeling that maybe it had some type of other chemicals that was involved in it to reduce certain behaviors. But nonetheless, it wasn't something that you would really consume, you want to consume on a regular.
Did you have any way to complain to the authorities about the food you were being given, or you know, any of the other people you knew when you incarcerated, or anything on a group basis like that?
You would have to form an inmate grievance. You could file an inmate grievance, but the inmate grievance is internal, and because of the vendors outside, it wasn't so much that it would be adhered to. It would only be like, we would look into it. We'll look into it, and we'll get back to you. We'll get back to it. We will change the diet. But what they changed the diet to was still something that was less than nutritional for mm-hmm. you. So if you wasn't aware of what the nutritional factors were for that particular diet, you would have thought, oh, okay, everything is good. But in actuality, it wasn't. It was still the same thing. It was right. Just that they changed the meal, and that was it. So the grievance process itself really didn't do anything except perform a psychological sedation for the person that filed it.
Psychological else, sedation. Good phrase. AJ, thank you so much for your call. And similar to that, somebody is tweeting, and of course we can't verify this, but somebody's tweeting, my mom developed diabetes this way. Very disparaging nutrition substitutes. Janet in Queens, you're on WNYC. Hi, Janet. Thank you so much for calling in.
Hi, I listen to you every day. It's so coincidental that you'll be covering this subject because an hour ago my grandson called me from Fulton County Prison in Georgia. And he asked me to write the mayor about the food that they're getting there. Because once he was transferred to Forsyth, it was quite different. The white community, quite different. And when they sent him back to Fulton County, he showed us what garbage he was eating, and he has asked me to write the mayor complaining about it. This was just an hour ago he called me.
To the mayor of Atlanta in this case, right?
Don't want to take up too much of
your time. No, no. You want to give us any details of what kinds of food and, you know, get even more specific?
Well,
I'm sure people would love to hear
it. I can even explain it because he showed us once on his my daughter's cell phone. He showed it once, and I don't know if it was grits, and the other thing looked like some kind of egg. Like, I just don't know what it was.
Janet, I wonder if we can get you some help. Bianca, do you want to take this? Because Janet's grandson is appealing to her to try to intervene about the food.
Yeah, I mean, we're happy, Janet, if you want to leave your information with the show's producers, we're happy to follow up. I think this, you know, this question is one, as, you know, Leslie has articulated so well, is one that's really plaguing people all over the country. And I want to say, I mean, we want to get relief for your son, for many of the others who are in those facilities. And it's always interesting to know, like, who are serving the actual food in those places, right? Because if you start thinking about the corporations that are serving that food, you start to think about those that actually we come into contact with every single day. So I don't know who's down in, like, what, you know, who has the contract over Fulton County Jail, but we'd more than happy to collect that. And I'd love to I speak a little bit about AJ's point, but I want to make sure we get her information first.
It was a white man up in Georgetown here in Washington. And everybody knew him. They called him the Wolf Man because he wore a long beard and long, scraggy hair. And he was out on the street. I mean, cold weather. He barely had enough clothes, I mean, to cover him. Sleeping on park benches. So some people who worked at some of the office buildings around there, including some black people, they went out there and started leaving him food and all like that, trying to help him. And one summer day, some interviewer sat down next to him and asked about him. Said, "Where'd you come from, you know?" Said, "They call you the Wolf Man. You've been around here for years and whatnot." Said, "What happened to you?" Said, "You know, maybe we can help you. You get on your feet and whatnot. I mean, you seem to have a little bit of sense and whatnot, and all like that." He said, "I don't need any help." He said, "People come and leave stuff here and all like that." He said, "I really don't need it." He said, "I got folks that got plenty of money. Been trying to get me to come stay with them and all like that. I don't want to go. I don't like them." Now, how many black people can say that? Who are out here on a park bench? Cinnamon?
Hennepin County homeless service providers have found a relatively simple fix to reduce racial inequities in who receives housing. And it has to do with an intake questionnaire that's been found to favor white people for permanent housing and to funnel people of color into less stable options. Hennepin County changed that process last year and is already seeing results. And here to talk more about that is David Hewitt. He heads the county's Office to End Homelessness. Good to speak with you again.
Thanks, Tom. Good to speak to you.
Now, for listeners who are not involved in the homeless services world, we need to do a little background or setup here. So talk us through this process, right? There's a questionnaire and various kinds of housing that someone might qualify for. How does it work?
Yeah, absolutely, Tom. And to take kind of the housing piece first, so time-limited support services help people find a home, help them with some initial rental subsidy, and then step away. And we generally call that rapid rehousing. We then have more intensive options, which are known as permanent supportive housing, where both the rental assistance and the support services are ongoing for as long as the household needs them. Both of these housing programs are limited in capacity. And that's where the process comes in that you're describing. So we, like the rest of the state and many communities across the country, we're using a standardized tool that measured vulnerability through a series of questions. And that point score was what led to somebody being prioritized when an opening came up in either a time limited or a permanent housing option.
So there was this questionnaire or a tool, as it's known,
And you found that it was contributing to racial inequities in housing placement. Tell me more about that.
A national organization called C4 conducted a large study. And what they found very clearly in their study was that the questions being asked were more likely to identify risks and barriers that were more prevalent amongst white people experiencing homelessness than they were amongst households of color and specifically African Americans experiencing homelessness. So that was of huge concern to us because people who experience homelessness are disproportionately people of color. But this tool was leading to a higher rate of, in particular, the most intensive interventions. You were more likely to be prioritized for those interventions if you were white.
Can you give us an example? For example, one of the questions or one of the data points that was increasing the inequity.
It goes back to why there is a disproportionality in who experiences homelessness. So if we look at family homelessness, we see an incredibly disproportionate rate at which African American families become homeless compared to white peers over and above poverty rates. But the economic factors that drive that were captured in the assessment, but only offered a certain amount of kind of the score as against kind of the chemical health, physical health pieces. So we need to look at when we're referring people to these interventions, are we directly tackling the inequity that we see in the system? And we have seen that since we have shifted that process, a rebalancing.
And tell me about that shifting. What changes did you make and what have the results been like?
The biggest thing we did was once we had the findings that said this tool is prioritizing in a way that is inequitable, we stopped using it. We reverted back to a simpler prioritization metric that really looked at how long has somebody been homeless? Do they have a disability? Are they a veteran? And then what are they eligible for? In the period immediately before the change, we saw almost 2/3 of African-American households that got referred to a housing resource got referred to one that was only very time limited. And we've basically seen that almost flip through this shift, where it's now closer to that 2/3 marker are getting referred to a non-time limited, ongoing, more intensive support.
David Hewitt heads up Hennepin County's Office to End Homelessness. I thank you for your time and perspective on this today. I wish you the best.
Thank you, Tom.
Technology, Lewis found, accelerated racial segregation rather than slowed it down. The wood pump made New Orleans East possible, but first came the interstate, which did nearly as much to reshape the geography of New Orleans. It would have been unthinkable to build an elevated highway above St. Charles Avenue or Magazine Street, yet that's what happened on the other side of town in the 1960s when the city fathers mapped the I-10 through the center of Treme. A white man's highway through the black man's bedroom, said one critic on the losing end of that fight. The interstate was built directly over Claiborne Avenue, the commercial center of black New Orleans. In its day, Claiborne was a handsome boulevard of large oak trees lined with businesses, most of them black owned. By the time of Katrina, it was a strip of vacant storefronts under a thick slab of elevated concrete thrumming with traffic. Lewis judged it as nothing short of murder.
This story is literally built into American culture. It's referred to in a song by John Mellencamp.
There's a black man with black hair, little black man I heard. He's got an interstate running through his front yard. You know, he thinks he's got it so good.
An interstate running through his front yard. When the U.S. built highways in the 20th century, many ran through black neighborhoods. Read of Robert Moses in New York or Richard Daley in Chicago, and you learn this story. President Biden's infrastructure plan includes money to repair the damage. Noel King spoke with Deborah Archer, president of the American Civil Liberties Union.
I want people to understand what this experience was like. And so I'm going to play some tape from a man named Sam Fullwood III. He grew up on the west side of Charlotte, North Carolina, and we came across his name in a paper you wrote called White Men's Roads Through Black Men's Homes. Now, he told us back in the day, his neighborhood was like Eden, basically. Here he is.
But that was in the early 1960s.
before the bulldozers uprooted the dogwoods and the oaks, gobbled up wide paved streets, and turned my playmates' homes into rubble. I vividly remember the change in terms that a little boy can understand. Jimmy Don Arnold, who had the largest and best comic book collection, tearfully told me one day he couldn't hang with the fellows anymore because the mysterious they were tearing down his house. William B.G. White's huge front yard, where we played pickup football games, became a mound of red dirt for an embankment to support an off-ramp to I-77.
That is a devastating story, and as your paper makes clear, it was not just Charlotte. This was happening all over the country.
That's right. It was certainly not an isolated incident, and communities around the country, when the interstate highway was built, it had a devastating impact of physical around segregation, but also, as you heard from Mr. Fullwood, psychological, as people in the community saw community institutions destroyed, their homes, they lost friends, churches, schools, and we see that lasting impact of the highway construction today.
Can you explain how this happened? Were there land seizures via eminent domain? Would the government offer payouts to people whose homes they were bulldozing?
Yeah, so I can take a step back. Following the passage of the Interstate Highway Act, the nation's highways were built through and around Black communities, destroying them, sometimes creating physical barriers to integration or to physically entrench racial inequality. And much of that was by design. And in communities around the country, federal and state highway builders purposefully targeted Black communities to make way for this massive highway project. And in some instances, they took homes by eminent domain. They claimed that communities were blighted when, in fact, they were vibrant.
Why would officials have targeted thriving, vibrant communities? Was it just because the people who lived there were Black and or brown?
Some of the time, yes, that was actually the case. The highways were being built just as courts around the country were striking down traditional tools of racial segregation. So, for example, courts were striking down the use of racial zoning to keep Black people in certain communities and white people in other communities. And so the highway development popped up at a time when the idea, the possibility of integration in housing was on the horizon. And so very intentionally, highways were sometimes built right on the former boundary lines that we saw used during racial zoning. Sometimes community members asked the highway builders to create a barrier between their community and encroaching Black communities.
Was there any successful resistance? Was there any resistance at all?
Oh, absolutely. There was certainly successful resistance. We can see good examples in Greenwich Village in New York. There were examples from Washington, D.C., which is where the phrase "no white man's roads through Black men's homes" came from. That was the rallying cry for folks in D.C. Who resisted it. And there was also a successful effort in New Orleans. But I think it's important to point out the most successful efforts to stop the highways were not those that focused on racial justice or those that were put in place to protect Black communities. The people who were most successful were the ones that focused on environmental justice and protecting parks and their communities in that way, not because we were concerned about the massive destruction and disproportionate impact that the highway construction had on Black communities.
And now President Biden wants to use his infrastructure plan to do just that. Let me ask, based on what you've seen of the plan, do you think this is an achievable goal?
I think the plan certainly holds promise. It could be truly transformative because it potentially represents an historic investment in urban communities and communities of color. Investments in transportation, but also in schools and water, are all really critically important factors in the ability of communities and people who live there to thrive and be healthy and to be happy. But what is not clear is whether and how that money will be distributed in a way that will address the racial inequalities that are built into our transportation system and our infrastructure. I think it's also important for us to think about how we will shift culture within the relevant agencies so that white middle class and affluent neighborhoods will not continue to be favored at the expense of communities of color.
And if this initiative works, in what ways do you see the country being different in 5 or 10 years?
I think that right now we can see that race frequently explains which communities receive the benefits of our transportation system and infrastructure and which communities were forced to host the burdens. Our transportation systems have really led to racial disparities and discrimination, which are reinforced daily from highways, roads, bridges to sidewalks and public transit. So I would hope that at the end of this project, at the end of this plan, as you say, in 5 years, that race would not be a way to explain who gets the benefits and who gets the burdens. It would not be a way to explain who has access and who doesn't.
Deborah Archer is president of the ACLU and a professor at New York University School of Law. Thank you so much for being with us. We really appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me.
Namaste.
Alabama has banned yoga instruction in public schools for the last 28 years, and now the state legislature is considering a bill that would let kids get back to the mat. The bill has passed the House, but it has stalled in a Senate committee. Conservative advocacy groups are concerned that, as they see it, yoga promotes Hinduism. Democratic State Representative Jeremy Gray introduced the bill that would bring yoga back to Alabama public schools, and he joins us now. Representative Gray, welcome to All Things Considered.
Thank you all for having me today.
Why would you like to see public school kids in Alabama practice yoga?
Me actually being a yogi and actually practicing yoga for the last 10 years, I really thought that it was something that, you know, kids could really take advantage of, especially in K through 12 public school. When we talk about stressors and anxiety and all those things that from a mental standpoint, it can really help people in K through 12 with. But when you talk about it from a physical standpoint, when you talk about mobility and flexibility and all those things it takes to be good in athletics. So I really thought it had more pros than cons. And I originally brought the bill because I was attending a high school to talk about my position as a lawmaker. And I was talking to the kids there and they talked about them essentially having a yoga class that they were going to start and they couldn't do it because of this law.
So you introduce this bill and it passes the House 73-25. Why did it run into a roadblock in the Senate? What happened?
The backstory is I've been working on this bill for 3 years in the House. So to the Senate, this is new. To the House, this is like 3 years in the making. And so some of those conservative groups that were in those articles and were kind of opposing the bill, after about 2019, they never kind of showed up again in the House. And so I feel like from a strategic standpoint, they want to go to the Senate and see could they rattle some minds up there. But the bill really stalled really due to the two votes that I needed to pass the bill out. They weren't there, and they're going to be here. And so this bill will be back on the calendar tomorrow.
What are people telling you about why this is running into roadblocks in the Senate? It seems like a strange objection that yoga promotes Hinduism and therefore shouldn't be taught in public schools.
Some of the people that were objecting it basically alluded doing yoga exercise converts you into Hindu or Hinduism, right? That was the whole premises of it. No real talking points of why or studies or anything that allude to that this actually happened. Most of these people who object this bill have never done yoga before. They probably don't even have kids in K through 12 public schools.
I feel like I should disclose here that I practice yoga and I'm Jewish. You say you've been practicing for 10 years or more. What do you make of this this opposition based on an idea that it converts a person to Hinduism?
This is asinine. I said, I mean, I've been a Christian my whole life at a Baptist church. I thought it was just foolish because, I mean, I'm a prime example that I hadn't converted to anything. And I've been doing yoga for a while now. So I just didn't understand how they could come with such comments and didn't have anything to back it. And I had so many people who emailed me and say, they're doing yoga at churches right now, like in this modern day. So we just didn't really understand where they came from.
Yeah.
And it really made us look foolish. I mean, a lot of people from other states reached out to me and say, yoga, really? Y'all arguing about yoga? I mean, I said, yeah, man, it's one of those things you like it's needed and you want to be an advocate for it, but it's really silly that we're actually debating over yoga.
That's Alabama State Representative Jeremy Gray. He is a Democrat. Thank you for talking with us.
Thank y'all for having me.
Black babies cost less.
Over the past year, we've seen how different systems in the U.S. have failed to adapt to the challenges created by the pandemic. And today, we wanted to focus on the foster care system. The pandemic has led to backlogs in the courts and fewer in-person parent visits, which has meant that children are left in foster care for much longer than they would have been pre-pandemic. Julia Lurie is a senior reporter at Mother Jones who has been covering this story. She joins us now. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, before we get into the problems that the pandemic caused in the foster care system, can you just tell us generally about what kinds of families end up in the foster care system? Like, what are the circumstances that usually get them there?
So there are about 400,000 kids in foster care at any given time. And, you know, I think a lot of people associate foster care and the child welfare system with parents who have been physically abusive or violent towards their kids. And in reality, the vast majority of cases are triggered by something called neglect, which is a catch-all category of offenses that are often caused by poverty and addiction.
Well, your reporting found that the pandemic set in motion a cascading set of circumstances that disrupted the foster care systems in a lot of cities and counties. One of the earliest things to happen is that a lot of courts simply shut down. And can you just tell us what domino effect flowed from that?
So in a typical year, a little more than half of the kids in foster care return to the permanent care of their biological parents. And that process is known as reunification. And experts agree that reunification is by far the best outcome, provided that, you know, parents can prove to be safe caregivers. And the pandemic hindered basically every stage of that reunification process. So you had courts slow down. You had visits between parents and their kids go virtual. And then the services that parents need to complete in order to move through their case, like parenting classes or addiction treatment, became a lot harder to access.
Can you talk about how this process normally works and how it changed because of the pandemic?
Over the course of a child welfare case, family visits typically progress from meetings that are overseen by a CPS-approved monitor to unsupervised overnights and weekends. And the visits really build on one another. So each one is a potential opportunity for parents to show caseworkers and ultimately the judge that they're ready for more time with their children, they're ready for more independence. But the pandemic took those visits virtual. And in a lot of places, parents and kids went months without seeing each other in person. So that's obviously incredibly challenging for moving their cases forward, but also just in the moment, it's incredibly challenging for the families.
Yeah. And the less they're able to bond, the less chance there is of reunification, right?
Exactly. So it's a process that really feeds on itself.
Is there a particular story that has stayed with you that you want to share about a family or a child that has just been on your mind since you've done this reporting?
Yeah, so over the course of several months, I was in touch with Stevie, who's a mom in Baltimore. And, you know, in a typical scenario, this family probably would have been reunited within a few weeks or months. As it ended up playing out, because of the slowdowns to the system, Stevie didn't see her kids in person for 4 months. And she didn't start getting regular visits with them for 6 or 7 months. And Stevie, you know, her son had just been born. And so she just didn't get that critical period of infancy with him. She felt like she didn't know him and he didn't know her. That family, happily now, has since been reunited. Stevie and her husband were able to get help. They have been off of drugs for a while now. And that family, like many now, is going to sort of have to see what the effect of this pandemic and that prolonged separation is going to mean for their relationship going forward. And we don't know quite yet.
Julia Lurie is a senior reporter at Mother Jones. Thank you very much for your reporting.
Thank you so much for having me.
Does this arrangement get a little tricky at times? Absolutely. But I try my best, you know. Ethically, my duty
ethically?
Is...
Ethically? I'm sorry. I must be hearing things.
did you actually just use the word ethically in a sentence?
President Biden announced today that all adult Americans will be eligible for a COVID-19 vaccine in just under 2 weeks.
Many states have already opened up to all adults. But beginning April 19th, every adult in every state, every adult in this country is eligible to get in line to get a COVID vaccination.
It's still going to be a while, though, for lots of reasons, before everyone or even most people get vaccinated. And as they do, it's likely some places where people gather will institute use of what has been called a vaccine passport. Now, this is an easy digital way to confirm that you have been vaccinated. The idea is that with proof of your status, you could do things like board a cruise or attend a ball game in person at an actual stadium. But there are ethical issues around this idea, which is something Dr. Zeke Emanuel has been thinking about. He's a professor of medical ethics at the University of Pennsylvania and former member of President Biden's Transition COVID-19 Advisory Board. Welcome.
Nice to be here. Thank you, Elsa, for having me.
Well, it's very nice to have you. So before we get into this debate about vaccine passports, you mentioned in a piece for the Journal of the American Medical Association last year that we shouldn't even call them so-called vaccine passports. Why is that?
Well, because it's really not a passport to necessarily cross borders. It's a certification. It's providing information about what your status is in some area.
Ah, I see. It could be potentially confusing to call it a passport.
Yeah.
Okay. And exactly why do you think that they are a good idea, this sort of presentation of a physical certification of your vaccine status?
Well, we're all under substantial restrictions now because of COVID. If you have a passport, that allows us to get to more normal behavior. And in public health, there's a principle that you should use the least restrictive method necessary. And this allows us to say those people who've gotten vaccinated, you don't have to adhere to certain restrictions because you are now immune, you're not likely to pass or transmit the virus.
Well, let's talk about some of the ways that people have pushed back on this idea. A couple of Republican governors have already signed executive orders limiting or outright prohibiting the use of these so-called vaccine passports. And you know, critics say that they have privacy concerns.
I completely am sympathetic to two major objections. One is, I won't say privacy only, but it's a constellation of issues that you want this information limited and you want to control the information. You don't want some big tech company like Facebook to commercialize it or to merge it with other information and then use it for their advantage, but not necessarily for your health. And second, I think there are legitimate concerns. Does everyone have equal access to the vaccine? Are we being fair in who's getting the vaccine, who's getting the passport, or, as we've seen, there's disproportionate availability of the vaccine in certain communities. And I think those are two quite legitimate concerns.
The White House has already indicated that it is disinclined to mandate their use. So how useful would these vaccine passports be in opening things up if there were no mandate, ultimately?
The federal government may be disinclined to mandate them, but that doesn't mean that many others won't be inclined to mandate them. I think they're inevitable. If only, the initial use case scenario will be international travel and maybe even some domestic travel. And I think from there, it's going to snowball, frankly.
Dr. Zeke Emanuel, professor of bioethics at the University of Pennsylvania and former member of President Biden's Transition COVID-19 Advisory Board. Thank you very much for joining us today.
My pleasure and honor. Thank you, Elsa, very much.
Medical apartheid, the dark history of medical experimentation on Black Americans from colonial times to the present.
Hey, Gary, can I ask you, have you gotten the COVID vaccine or are you planning on getting the COVID vaccine?
Yes, I'm already vaccinated. Thank you for access.
All right. Harriet Washington, you write in Medical Apartheid, to peg off Gary's question, Black iatrophobia is the fear of medicine.
Yes, and that fear is often justified by history. It's interesting that we often talk about the fear of medicine among African Americans without also talking about the untrustworthiness of the U.S. healthcare system. These to go hand in hand. You can't talk about African American behavior without talking about the healthcare system, which has routinely and consistently failed them or even abused them. You know, if you do, then the implication is that African American behavior is a problem. Like the problem is that Black people want to avoid certain types of care or don't trust certain types of care. No, the problem is that we have a system that, you know, creates disparities, that abuses people, in particular African Americans, punishes them for seeking medical care, for example. I talked earlier about the belief, the very persistent contemporary belief that African Americans don't feel pain the way whites do. That means when Black people in pain come to hospitals, they're often, in fact, they're routinely turned away as drug seeking. So in that case, whose fault is it? Is it a Black person being afraid of care, or is it a healthcare system? Having said all that, there is also the fact that sometimes African Americans, as Gary points out, do avoid certain types of healthcare or don't get types of healthcare as often. But again, you know, we don't know in cases like that how often people are actively avoiding the care. Are Black African American or African American gay men, are they avoiding PrEP? Are they not trusting PrEP? Or is it less likely being held out to them as an option? It's really important to find out what's going on. Unless we look and do studies designed to find out, then we can't know what is happening. And I'm really glad, Peter, that you brought up the vaccine, because it's a parallel case. We've been reading all last summer, lots of, you know, daily headlines saying African Americans were didn't want to sign up for clinical trials for COVID-19. African Americans were afraid to join the clinical trials. Every day we read those headlines. But when the data were published, I got the original data from a researcher at Johns Hopkins. And what I saw in that data was that 10% of people in the Moderna trial and 10% in the Pfizer-BioNTech trial were African Americans. African Americans are 12.3% of the population. That means that African Americans were signing up at the rate in the population. There was no whole-scale abandonment. There was no refusal. We were right there. And in fact, my question is, who's tracking white Americans? How often were they signing up for clinical trials? Were they signing up at the same rate as the population? Were only 50% of them? You know, so the question is, why are we scrutinizing African-American behavior, and why are we so often calling it avoidant or aversive behavior, when in reality, it could be just as easily lack of access? Or maybe, as with the vaccine trials, we're right there and not being acknowledged. But Gary, because you seem to be following this really well and knowledgeable about it, let's assume that it's exactly as you feared, and the African Americans are avoiding it. So then the question becomes, after you rule out access problems, because are they actually being offered at the same rate of whites, then it becomes a matter of trying to make sure African Americans understand the advantage to them and find out if there are any fears, find out what they are. You can't ally them without knowing what the fears are and then addressing them. So it's a matter of doing a little research, because we have to find out what's really going on. Maybe that's not being offered to them as often. And we have to find out, if they're avoiding it, why are they avoiding it? And then we can zero in on it and try to raise those numbers to where they should be. That is really an excellent question, Gary. Thank you for asking it.
Barbara in New York City, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Peter. Good afternoon, Ms. Washington. Two questions, please, in the book, Carte Blanche. In a little local newspaper here, a woman wrote an article about vacillating on vaccine, and she was asking why New Yorkers are still refusing to get the vaccine shot. And at the end of her article, she makes a statement implying that it's the duty of people to get the shot. And in your book, you talk about how individuals are told that it's they have a moral responsibility to participate in research. Would you speak about whether we have a duty or a moral responsibility to take the COVID vaccine? And secondly, in your book, you talk about birking, a murder in order to sell the body to anatomists. And you say there was one documented instance of that. Could you explain when and where that happens? Thank you so much.
Barbara, why did you pick up carte blanche?
I saw that Miss Washington was going to be on your show, and I rushed out and got it. And I have her other book, Medical Apartheid, and I just think she's wonderful.
Are you a medical professional in any way?
No, I'm not.
Thanks for calling in, Barbara.
Barbara, before you go, repeat your question about refusing the coronavirus vaccine.
Okay, so the lady wrote an article in this little newspaper called and the title is Vacillating on Vaccines, and mm-hmm. she's asking the questions, why are New Yorkers still refusing to get the COVID vaccine? At the end of it, she implies you have a duty to get the COVID vaccine.
Thank you. Well, I'll take your last question first, Barbara, and that is the only documented birking. And that's a murder to sell the body to people doing anatomy in a hospital. The only documented birking in this country took place in Baltimore, but it has been well documented. And I don't, of course, remember offhand the particulars, except that it was a white woman living in a black neighborhood who was involved with a black man. And what's significant is that this was well documented, but black people in the area claim that, and still claim, that many black bodies had also been used. So the one of the white women is documented, the one of the black bodies is still, was never documented. Very, very concerning, but it happened a long time ago, and hopefully that's nothing like that is still being done today. In terms of any moral responsibility for accepting the coronavirus vaccine, that's actually a tricky one. There are people who argue that there was a moral responsibility, and their point is that the more people who are vaccinated, the more better protected are people who cannot accept vaccination. So by accepting vaccination against coronavirus, you're not only protecting yourself, you're protecting other people, including people who cannot receive the vaccination for some reason. Maybe they're immunocompromised, maybe they're too young, maybe they have an allergy to one of the ingredients. There are people who cannot do it. Also, vaccines are not infallible. Vaccines, even though they're well designed and they work really well on most people, they may not work for certain people. Certain individuals. So the more people who are vaccinated, the better the chance we have as a community, as a country, of avoiding illness altogether. So the argument is that if you can be vaccinated, you really should be vaccinated to protect other people. And that argument has moral authority to it. It's hard to argue with that. But going from that to saying that it's an imperative that we should force people to get vaccines, force people to become vaccinated, that's quite a step. And sometimes it should be undertaken. I'm not really equipped to say whether it's something that we should mandate by law. I think that mandating it by law is something we should consider, but I'm not sure that we should do it. So that's kind of a tricky thing. The problem, of course, is that Americans, we love our freedom, right? How many things have we seen invoked in the name of freedom of speech that people in other countries would not necessarily see as freedom of speech? So we love our freedom, and we don't take kindly to being told we have to do something. And yet that's a tool in public health that I sometimes think we don't use often enough. So I'm not prepared to say that vaccines should be mandated by law. I am prepared to say that wearing masks should be mandated by law for the simple reason that it's protective. We know it to be protective. And right now we so often rely upon organizations or institutions to enforce it who are not able to. I mean, how often, how many videos can you see of people in a Whole Foods refusing to wear a mask and exposing other people before you realize that the Whole Foods people are not necessarily equipped to enforce this? If it has to be enforced, it should be enforced by the government. So this is something that is a tool that we need to consider using more often. In the case of vaccination, though, I'm not quite sure, especially because a lot of the claims about people refusing vaccines I find to be spurious. People, African-Americans in particular, who are being accused of refusing vaccines, just like the African-Americans who are accused of not signing for clinical trials, but indeed did, African-Americans not getting vaccines now, actually a lot of it is due to a lack of access. We actually have had policies that separate African-Americans from vaccination. We have practices that separate them from vaccination. And so mandating it by law would be problematic because you're going to end up punishing people for things that are not their fault. You know, if we have a policy that dictates that people who are 85 and older get priority, then you have to face the fact that in this country, African Americans, Hispanic Americans, Native Americans are all young populations, much less likely to reach that age of 85. 90-year-olds in this country, you have twice the rate of 90-year-olds who are white as 90-year-olds who are black in this country. So when you have a policy that prioritizes and privileges people who are 85 and older, you're actually operating against people of color. We should certainly be prioritizing older people. I'm not saying that we should be doing it, but we also have to prioritize people of color who are also at higher rates, higher risk of infection. So we need better policies, not punishing people for things that are not their doing.
Harriet Washington, have you gotten your vaccine, and what kind of research did you do if you did get it or didn't?
I got my vaccine, but I'm the first one to admit that although I was happy there's a vaccine, very happy these mRNA vaccines worked out well, they could be produced very quickly, they're very effective, they seem to be extremely safe. But how much research can one really do? They had, of necessity, the vaccines were indeed generated more quickly and without the same meticulous data that we require for other vaccines. That's just a fact of life. We did not have the luxury of an extra 5 or 6 years, you know, to dot all the I's and cross all the T's. So I think we did the right thing not to do that. But it also means that we were relying upon companies' own certifications that their vaccine had a 96% effectiveness or efficacy, not quite the same thing. But the thing was, in my opinion, it was the only logical step. I was very happy we had a vaccine. I embraced the vaccine because look at the alternative. The longer people take to embrace the vaccine, I try to make it very clear to people that it's not 100% guaranteed that there'll be no problems. That's an unrealistic goal. But it's 100% guaranteed that if you don't take the vaccine, you're a much higher rate of becoming infected, of infecting someone else, and falling victim to a variant that could be much worse than what we're seeing now. I worry about the people who say they're going to wait and see. In fact, I talked to a doctor who's written very well about this at MGH. And one of the problems with saying I'm going to wait and see what happens is that the longer you wait, the more chance that you're going to be exposed to some variant that will be worse than what people are experiencing now and end up more ill and spread that variant. So it's a dangerous thing to wait and see. It's very clear that the best possible course is to take the vaccine.
And MGH is Massachusetts General?
Yes, thank you. Thank you for pointing that. Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston, right. So taking the vaccine, in my opinion, is the only logical route. It's the thing to do. I'm grateful that we have, I'm glad we have that option. And if it hasn't been made abundantly clear by now, it's really important to realize that African Americans, like other Americans, understood that. That's why we were in the clinical trials, despite all the headlines to the contrary. And that's why I'm convinced that it is a lack of access that's hampering African Americans from getting the vaccine in greater numbers. There's a lot of noise, a lot of headlines, a lot of anecdotal focus on African Americans who don't want to take the vaccine, but I'm convinced that those numbers are dwarfed by the many people who want the vaccine and are having a hard time getting it.
Freedom of speech! Just watch what you say. Freedom of speech! Yeah, just watch what you say. Freedom of speech! Yeah, boy, just watch what you say.
Lawmakers in Florida are moving forward with a bill that imposes new penalties on those who act badly during protests. The measures were proposed by Florida Governor Ron DeSantis in response to Black Lives Matter protests following the death of George Floyd. Republicans, who control Florida's legislature, say the bill protects law and order. Democrats and civil rights groups say it violates free speech protections and targets racial minorities. From Miami, NPR's Greg Allen reports.
When Governor DeSantis unveiled plans for the bill in September, he was quite clear about what inspired it.
I think that this has been a really, really sad chapter in American history. Now,
that was just several weeks after protests erupted following the death of George Floyd. At this protest in Miami in June, several people were arrested for vandalizing a statue of Christopher Columbus. Under the proposed law, if the damage were great enough, that would be a felony. On the whole, protests here were mostly peaceful, something DeSantis acknowledged.
We are not going to let Florida go down the road that some of these other places have gone.
Florida's House has already passed its version of the governor's proposal. It raises the penalties for violence, theft, burglary, and property damage committed during protests, making some former misdemeanors felonies. The bill creates a new crime, mob intimidation, and it also reacts to the defund police movement, allowing officials to appeal any decision to reduce funding to law enforcement. At a hearing in Florida's Senate today, Democrat Gary Farmer said the bill was an attack on freedom of speech and the right of people to peacefully protest.
This language could be used and interpreted and applied in a way to subject peaceful protesters to punishment for crimes that they simply happen to be present for.
The sponsor of the bill, Senator Danny Burgess, a Republican, filed it on January 6th and has cited the Capitol insurrection as one of the inspirations for the measure. At today's hearing, he conceded that the bill actually was drafted long before that, but he maintained the measure wouldn't deter peaceful protests. In fact, he said it would do the opposite.
It's my hope that this will preserve and protect the right to peaceful protests and further detract from those who try to take away from the merits of that protest.
Some of the toughest questions for Burgess came from Democratic State Senator Bobby Powell. Powell, who's African American, asked the bill's sponsor to think back to 1965, when former Congressman John Lewis was one of many who were brutally attacked by police when they attempted to march over a bridge in Selma, Alabama.
Would he be subject to criminal penalties under this particular piece of legislation?
Following discussions about penalties protesters would face for blocking roadways or assaulting police, it was a question that clearly made Burgess uncomfortable. The attack on protesters that day, he said, was shocking and a stain on U.S. history.
I don't believe anything in this bill would ever not protect somebody like John Lewis.
Burgess said he'd never bring forward a bill that's racist. But along with other Republicans, he opposed a series of unsuccessful amendments that would have set up procedures for monitoring the new law's racial impact. One of those speaking in opposition to the bill was James Golden, an AME church minister.
This is not about race. It's worse than that. It's about power and about the abuse of power.
With Republicans in control in Florida, the bill is expected to be approved by the Senate and signed by the governor. Similar bills are being considered in several other states. Greg Allen, NPR News, Miami.
The man-knot. Race, class, genre, and the dilemmas of black manhood.
Clay Depew remains on leave tonight from the Jackson Marshal's office weeks after being accused of choking a teenager and using racial slurs outside the Main Street Market gas station. But what the 9 News investigators have uncovered now calls into question whether he should even be on the force at all.
Is it a red flag for you that this officer was arrested and fired from another agency back in 2017?
He should have never been hired. Yes, a red flag. It's not just a red flag. It's a hard stop.
Andrew Scott, a retired police chief and law enforcement expert out of Florida, says Depew should never have been given a gun and a badge in Jackson.
Based on my expertise, knowledge, and training, absolutely. Should have never been hired.
According to these arrest reports, Depew was arrested for stalking and malfeasance in office back in 2017. As a result, he was fired from the Pointe Coupee Sheriff's Office. We tried to find out more information about those charges, but we've learned they were expunged on February 9th this year, a little more than 2 weeks before he was accused of choking a 16-year-old and calling him the N-word.
These are the types of incidences that undermine law enforcement credibility and trust with the community. Why would you hire somebody with such a criminal history? I don't have an answer for that, because I can tell you that my agency and the agencies I've worked for and that I was chief of police of, I wouldn't hire that individual.
Here's surveillance video from the night Depew is accused of choking that 16-year-old. The teen's family claims the situation was so bad, another officer had to step in to stop him. The only problem, there's no body camera video of the encounter. It's something the family's attorney, Ron Haley, calls troubling.
Listen, we have seen this movie play out. What is the point of having body cams if they're not going to be turned on?
I equate body cameras as evidence. And when an officer intentionally either turns off the body cam or ignores putting it on, he or she is literally tampering with evidence that could be germane in a case.
We don't yet know why there's no body camera video of the encounter, because the case is still being investigated. But the 9 News investigators do know Depew was equipped with the camera. The Jackson Marshal's office now tells us their deputies are equipped with body cameras and have been since 2015. According to this body camera policy we requested from the Marshal's office, it clearly says officers should activate their cameras for all contacts with citizens.
At the very least, would the officer be in violation of that policy?
Sure, absolutely. Now, the question begs, what is going to be the punishment?
For the 9 News investigators, I'm Scotty Hunter.
Death row, what a criminal. Death row, what a criminal. Death row, what a criminal. Death row, what a criminal.
What happens when a district attorney suspects that a past miscarriage of justice put a man on death row? Well, one answer is playing out in Alabama, where pressure is mounting to grant a new trial for a man convicted on scant evidence of murdering a sheriff's deputy more than 20 years ago. Now, prominent legal voices, including former prosecutors, are getting behind the legal push to re-examine the case. As NPR's Debbie Elliott reports, it is one of dozens getting a new look as district attorneys around the country review the integrity of past prosecutions.
Teforis Johnson was 25 years old when he was sentenced to death in 1998 for the killing of a sheriff's deputy outside Birmingham. His oldest daughter, Shania Poole, now 29, remembers being in the courtroom.
I just wanted to talk to him. He looked so handsome. He had a suit on, and of course, I didn't really know what was going on. I may have been 4 or 5 years old at the time. And I saw him walk away, and that was the last day of his freedom.
Ever since, Johnson has maintained his innocence, and his family has worked to overturn what they see as a wrongful conviction.
He's beautiful. Thank you. Hello, how are you?
Antonio Green, Johnson's cousin, has come to Poole's Birmingham home to talk about the lingering questions over Johnson's case.
The records that the courts have say that there is no way you can take a man's life based on what you have.
The cousins were roommates when Johnson was arrested in the murder of Jefferson County Sheriff's Deputy William Hardy, shot to death while working an off-duty security detail at a hotel in 1995. It was a high-profile murder with few clues and no eyewitnesses. The state put up a $5,000 reward. Tofores Johnson became a suspect based on a tip from a teenager who later admitted she was after the reward money and changed her story dozens of times. In a series of trials, prosecutors raised conflicting theories as to who the shooter was. Defense witnesses gave Johnson an alibi. After a hung jury, Johnson was prosecuted a second time and convicted based on the testimony of one person. Not an eyewitness, but an ear witness, a woman who overheard a jailhouse phone conversation in which someone named Tofores said he shot a deputy. Green, who says he supports the death penalty, still can't understand how his cousin was convicted of murder.
They had no evidence, no reason, no justifiable reason to say this is our man and we know it.
Yeah. So it really opened my eyes to the fact that, unfortunately, the justice system is not equal.
Prosecutors never revealed they paid the witness $5,000. That issue is before a state appeals court. But a broader legal groundswell is underway after the Jefferson County District Attorney reviewed the case and sought a new trial last summer. Tofores Johnson's daughter, Shania Poole, says finally people are listening.
We have some very powerful and influential people that have rallied behind my family and my father. We're very hopeful that, you know, we'll be able to bring him home.
Among the influential voices calling for justice is former Alabama Attorney General Bill Baxley, who worked in the 1970s to have the death penalty reinstated. His son, also a lawyer, asked him to look at Tofores Johnson's case. Baxley says at first he was skeptical. Then he read the documents.
I couldn't believe what I was reading. It was just unconscionable.
He was stunned by the lack of evidence against Johnson, particularly the ear witness. Baxley says overhearing a phone conversation is shaky.
Now, this lady that testified to that had never met Tofores Johnson. She had never heard him speak. She didn't, as we used to say when I was young in Alabama, didn't know him from Adam's house cat.
Baxley and other former state and federal prosecutors have joined in a friend of the court brief to intervene in the case.
It's terrible that he's been on death row all these years, but it's still time to correct the injustice and keep it from getting worse.
And it's not only prosecutors weighing in. Former judges filed a brief calling the case a, quote, reprehensible miscarriage of justice that may otherwise lead to the execution of a likely innocent man. It's signed by two former chief justices of the Alabama Supreme Court. There's a brief from legal scholars, another from faith-based groups, and from public defenders in the criminal defense bar, all represented by some of Alabama's most prestigious law firms.
This is extraordinarily unusual.
University of Alabama law professor Joyce White Vance is a former U.S. attorney for the Northern District of Alabama who signed on the prosecutor's brief. She says this case comes as more and more district attorneys are looking back with a new racial justice lens, establishing units to make sure prior convictions stand up.
Since 2002, these conviction integrity units have processed more than 400 cases where people were wrongfully convicted. So most of the time, law enforcement gets it right. Most prosecutors are fine people who are committed to fairness and justice. But it's clear that there are some flaws in the system, and it's our obligation to correct those.
Jefferson County DA Danny Carr had promised during his campaign to establish a conviction integrity unit. The Tofores Johnson case was among the first to get reexamined. Carr declined an interview with NPR. Birmingham attorney Lindsay Boney represents the Innocence Project in Johnson's case. He says Carr's motion for a new trial is groundbreaking.
He met with witnesses and with the victim's family, and he met with the line prosecutor. And last June, Danny Carr said, I think Tofores Johnson deserves a new trial. And that was a very significant bombshell filing. The courts that now have jurisdiction over this case ought to take notice that there's something here.
What's striking is that Carr says the original lead prosecutor has concerns about the case and supports a new trial. Boney says the legitimacy of the judicial system is at stake.
It really is a case where the state should step back.
But Alabama's top law enforcement officer, Attorney General Steve Marshall, is fighting Johnson's death row appeal. He declined an interview. A spokesman says the office has not taken a position on all the briefs seeking a new trial because those legal filings are on hold until the reward money disclosure issue is resolved.
Oh, here's a group picture.
Shania Poole keeps old photographs of her playing with her father when she was a toddler. In this one, her dad has squeezed his grown body into a child's backyard playset.
Look at this one. You can just see the joy on his face. I love that picture of him.
Tofores Johnson is now 48 years old and has been on Alabama's death row for nearly half his life. His five children are grown and have children of their own. Poole says they maintained their bond through Friday visits and lots of phone calls and letters. Poole says her dad has not given up on the justice system. She's optimistic they're at last getting the traction they need to clear his name.
My hope is that Tofores Johnson will be the reason why the next man won't have to go through two decades behind bars for something that he or she didn't do.
Poole says her father's case is not an anomaly, but a symptom of a system that needs repair. Debbie Elliott, NPR News, Birmingham.
What does it mean to rank racism as a threat to public health? The head of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention just did that. Dr. Rochelle Walensky points to the disproportionate effects of coronavirus. She says they come after generations of discrimination that do affect people's health. So let's consider that reading of history and what it means for public health policy today. Dr. Kamara Phyllis-Jones is with us this morning. She is an epidemiologist and studies race and health at the Morehouse School of Medicine and Emory University. Dr. Jones, welcome to the program.
Good morning, Steve.
I just want to acknowledge this is obviously not a new idea to some people who've studied this for decades, but I'm imagining it is rather new or seems jarring to some people, the idea that racism affects not just your attitudes or your job opportunities, but your health. What in general is the idea that racism affects public health?
Well, basically, first of all, there are differences in health outcomes by so-called race across the country that have been documented for decades and centuries. The question is, why do we see these differences? And we know enough now to know that they are not based in our genes, because there is no genetic difference between humans, you know, that would cause so-called races or racial subspeciation.
Right.
That what we see as race is not something that's deeply in our genes in terms of health. It's not in our cultures. It is affected by social class, but there is, it doesn't just so happen that Black people and Indigenous people and Latinx people and Pacific Islander people and others are overrepresented in poverty. So when you try to figure out why are we seeing these health disparities by race, you need to figure out what does this race thing capture, and you need to get to root causes. Race is the social interpretation of how we look in this society, where opportunity is differentially structured by this so-called race, and even the basic value that we assign to different people differs by race. It's because of racism as a root cause of these health disparities.
You just pointed to one way that this would work when you said poverty. If you discriminate against a group of people, if it's harder for them over generations to build up wealth and get ahead, they are also often less healthy. You don't eat as well. You're not able to live as well. You just don't have the same kinds of opportunities. So that's the historic trend. Did the pandemic just make this all more obvious for us?
Yes. Yes, it did. Well, it's because we knew at the beginning of the pandemic that all humans were equally susceptible, I would say, to the COVID-19, that none of us was immune.
Yeah.
So if opportunity were equally distributed, if exposure risk was equally distributed, there would be no way that we could slice and dice the population to see differences in who is getting infected or who is dying. So it just showed that opportunity is not equally distributed by race in this country. It showed that exposure to risk is not equally distributed, that people of color are more likely to get infected with COVID-19 because we've been more exposed in the frontline jobs, more exposed in crowded housing and the like, and less protected. And then once infected, people of color are more likely to die because we're more burdened by chronic diseases that come from living in poor neighborhoods, disinvested neighborhoods, with environmental hazards and no good food and no green space and the like, with less access to health care. So what COVID-19 did was just expose again racism as a root cause, the same way that Hurricane Katrina exposed the poisoning of the Flint water supply. There have been many times that we could open our eyes and see that opportunity is not equally distributed in this society by race. But what happens is we open our eyes and then we close them again.
So a couple of years ago, we had an interview on this program with Kamala Harris, then a presidential candidate, now the vice president of the United States. And I asked her about reparations. And she began talking about this public health problem as something that could be addressed. You can't give payments to people who were enslaved generations ago and are now dead, but you have these generational effects that have continued with discrimination today, including public health effects, and that requires some kind of intervention, she said then. So if you're thinking about public policy, what form could that intervention take?
Massive investments in communities of color, so that we improve housing, clean up the environment, improve the schools so we have excellent public schools for all of our kids, that we start investing again in wealth building. It's not, as I say, these differences that we see between communities of color and white communities didn't just so happen. There were real historical injustices like the taking of the land from American Indians or the enslavement of Africans and using our unpaid labor for centuries to build this country that have never been addressed. In this country, we don't even pay much attention to history. We are so ahistorical, we act like the present was disconnected from the past.
And it's not, of course.
And that's the current distribution. It's not.
And let me just, if I could just, I've just got a few seconds left, and I'm so sorry to cut you off. We could go on forever on this discussion. But I'd like to know, as you observe the Biden administration, do you see them just making a statement about this or laying the groundwork for serious different policies about it?
I am very heartened that first you have to make the statement. First you have to name racism, because if you never name it in our widespread culture of racism denial, then you're complicit with the denial. So you have to name a thing, but you then have to move to action. I think, yes, the Biden administration has made the first step and is moving toward action. Yes.
Dr. Jones, it's a pleasure talking with you. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Dr. Kamara Phyllis Jones is at Morehouse and Emory University.
Context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Saturday, April 10, 2021. So I have been told. The last segment, Dr. Kamara P. Jones. I hear her from time to time, so I'll see reports, and I always give a slight grin. She used to work at the Centers for Disease Control. That's probably why they contacted her. She's not there now, but she used to. But I remember way back eons ago when the cows first started, I attempted to contact her when she was still with the CDC. And you can imagine, like, the gauntlet of people that you have to speak with to get access, and will they allow her to speak as a member, as an employee of the CDC. And I'm just speaking to them on the phone, and it was not a courteous, pleasant, like, oh gosh, you want to talk to her about racism? Oh, that's wonderful. That's what all of her, it was, no, it was not that at all. Like, anywho, be that as it may, she's not at the CDC, and now they've declared racism a serious health problem. How about that? Wonder what Dr. Wilson would have to say about that. Anywho, this is our weekly compensatory call-in. Dial in if you have thoughts, observations, counter-racist suggestions. The number is 720-716-3846. 7300, the code 564-943-#. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Number again, 720-716-7300. The code 564-943-#. Press *61 if you would like to participate. There was so much like last week. There was so much that happened this week. We really could have done probably every week, but I mean easily this week, we could have done just 3 hours of what are some of the major news events that happened in the world the past 7 days. And salute, nothing else to say, no time for commentary. We didn't even get our weekly update on the Derek Chauvin trial. We didn't get commentary on the death of Prince Philip. Well, I was going to say suspected race soldier, but there were a lot of articles this week saying this guy is a racist and going evidence. Look what he did here. Look what he said here. Look what he did here. And they didn't even get to the whole Meghan Markle thing. The passing of DMX, we just had that report, I think within the past few weeks, talking about the alarming number of black male hip-hop artists who end up dying very young, like 40s, 30s, you know, not hanging out for a long time and having an illustrious career and sit back and get all their royalties and, you know, go do their rock and roll Hall of Fame induction at 85 and all, and checking out of here at 45. And DMX, better, I think his authentic name, given name, Earl Simmons, dead at the age of 50. That right there, if anything, is why the CDC says, hey, racism, white supremacy, serious public health threat. DMX, deceased at 50. Lots of things that we could have talked about. They had the NFL. They had a suit where black players were not being compensated for all of the brain damage that they accumulate. More black male privilege, just oodles and oodles of that this week. But they're not being they're black male NFL players not being compensated at the same rate as white players. And they talked about there was a specific test procedure that helped explain, much like the segment that we heard about white people who are homeless getting more help so that they get out of their situation quicker. Same thing was happening with the NFL compensation. I believe when we discussed this before, brain damage and CTE, Amon Green, former NFL player with the Green Bay Packers, he was one of the players that was talking about all this and saying, man, they're not compensating us correctly. And now we got brain damage. They used us for all these years and now they want to compensate us correctly. Retired firefighter said, hey, I know that victim. Amon Green, out of the great industry of black athletes down here in the South Florida area. Maybe could have twisted his arm, as they say, and got him to hang out on the cows for a little bit. If that is true, and retired firefighter is listening, I said we have our whites only policy, but just for the remainder of the year, that was last year, I said we'll have a non-white guest from time to time. If you would like or are able to speak with Mr. Green, I would love to chat it up about this here brain damage compensation suit, what he thinks about all this, if this has changed his perspective on what he thinks about football, if he has offspring, does he allow his offspring to play football? Like, lots of questions about, all, like, what is the extent of the brain damage? Like, does he have difficulty functioning? Lots of questions. So if Mr. Green would be agreeable, we will be on our best behavior. I promise we will not ask him about does he have any white friends or if he's had sexual intercourse with a white person or anything like that. We will behave. Just talk about the CTE, brain damage, NFL stories, and racism. But that would be great. We'd love to hear from Amon Green. But we didn't even get include that. There were just so many things. In fact, there was Phillip Adams, different former black NFL player who is accused of having killed, I believe, five people in South Carolina died this week. That's the charge. I saw that. So many shootings, you can't even keep up with them all. But they said they were going to review his brain for CTE, brain damage, another illustration of black male privilege. But they had a report where his father was saying, man, football messed him up. Now, certainly, everybody who goes out to play football does not go out and commit homicide. I think retired firefighter, I think he might have played a little football from time to time. I've never heard of him going out and doing an O.J. Simpson, forgive the metaphor. So everyone who goes out and scores a touchdown or tries to throw a block doesn't become a homicidal killer. But it is not possible to play football safely. Tackle football, it is not possible to play tackle football without getting brain damage. And especially if you're playing like professionally, NCAA, collegiate level, oh yeah, you're going to get a teaspoon of brain damage and maybe extra heaping if you have a lengthy career, people like Mr. Amon Green and such. But it was lots to discuss this week. Like, wow, you just kind of had to process what you can, take breaks when you need to, and guard your mental health. Proceeding, let's see, lengthy list of things before we get to the listeners. Invest if you think the cows is constructive. Listener supported counter racist radio. Hit the blog racism-notes.blogspot.com. racism-notes.blogspot.com. You will see my PayPal button in the top right corner. Much obliged for the many folks who have invested a dozen plus years. I hope the cows has been, continues to be worthy of your time and energy. You can also hit my Cash App. It is linked on the blog, the address cash.app/$thecows. Again, extraordinary gratitude to the many investors who have kept the cows on the air 12 years and still broadcasting, hopefully offering accurate, constructive information on what it means to be white, what the system of white supremacy racism is, how it can be replaced with justice. Let's see. One of our listeners posted on my Facebook page this past Sunday, which was April 4, important date, they posted Harriet A. Washington. She was going to be on C-SPAN for Book TV. Incidentally, she Book TV in general, they do like 2-hour, 3-hour interviews all the time with people like Dr. Gerald Horn, Harriet A. Washington, some of the very people who've been on this program. So many times over the years, I've heard folks say, my gosh, why do you have a 3-hour program that's so long? And I look at me like, man, Book TV is 3 hours. They do the exact same thing. They've been on way longer than the context of white supremacy. And then I'll be really insulted. Like, if you look online, there'll be people who do like videos that are 3 hours just on video games, watching them play video games, watching them laugh at other people play video games, and it'll have like millions of views. So if a 3-hour video for Book TV or watching video games can happen and be popular, then I think 3 hours for counter racism is acceptable. And they're not always 3 hours. Anyway, Harriet A. Washington was on for 2 hours on Book TV. She's been on many times before. She has a new book. I was so excited, even though I didn't grasp this or conclude this until recently. Like, I guess Harriet A. Washington is my favorite author. I was thinking maybe it was Toni Morrison or someone else, not Harriet A. Washington, but she has 2 books in my top 10. We read them both in the book club, Medical Apartheid, A Terrible Thing to Waste, spectacular, both of them, lots of constructive details. So she has a new book. I'm excited. Carte Blanche. I should check it out. Maybe we'll get to it on the book club. So I was thinking we should get to that on the book club immediately. Like, my goodness. So she talked a little bit about the new book, and then she talked a little bit about medical apartheid. And in fact, for people from the book club, we read Rebecca Skloot, The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks. She spent a good deal of time talking about Henrietta Lacks and critiquing the book that Rebecca Skloot wrote. In fact, she talked about she wanted to write a book on Henrietta Lacks, and she talks about the racist resistance that she got to what she thought was important about the Henrietta Lacks story. And they didn't want to do that. Same thing like with medical apartheid. Like she talks about that in the book, the resistance that she got, like, hey, why are you talking about this? We don't even want to give you access to this information. So she's talked, which people who were with us for Rebecca Skloot's book, you should read and hear what she has to say about all that. It was super constructive. And then if you have a good memory, you'll remember some of the critiques that we had of the book that Skloot wrote, who's a white woman. Anyway, so she gets past all that. Of course, they get to the whole COVID-19 situation. We heard some of what she had to say there, but she also talked about reading is more important than watching television. She did the interview and she had her bookcase in the back, or at least I suspect one of her bookcases with a good bit of her literature. But she also talked about the book, The Organ Thieves by Chip Jones, also written by a white man. So this book is about, I haven't finished reading yet, but I got it. This book is about the first heart transplant and how apparently white people, usual suspects, stole the heart from a black male privilege. They stole his heart, gave it to a white person. That's the first heart transplant. So The Organ Thieves, written by Chip Jones, that's what this book is about, nonfiction. So Harriet A. Washington wrote a review of this book, and she said that he, Mr. Jones, omits a lot of the historical context around this. And if you recall, she has a whole chapter in her book, Medical Apartheid, that talks about how the grave digging and how it was so common that black slaves would say, man, I hope I die in the summertime. That way I'll decompose really, really quick and they won't have a chance to dig me up and, you know, do whatever once I have kicked the bucket, as they say. But she said that he doesn't do a quality job in unearthing, pardon the pun, this pertinent historical context. And there are even some newer books that, you know, go in detail in talking about this. But anyway, Mr. Jones will be here on Tuesday. I hadn't heard of his book, but she mentioned it. And I thought, oh, great. Hey, white guests only, as I just said. So he should be here Tuesday. I'm going through the book right now. If you have time between now and Tuesday, read The Organ Thieves, especially if you read Rebecca Skloot's book or Medical Apartheid or have some interest in this field, medical field. Check it out. Be prepped. Always enjoy taking advantage to get better questioning white people. All of that said, I thought it was really interesting what Harriet A. Washington had to say about the vaccine, the COVID situation. She says she got her vaccine. She is not a doctor. That's it. I didn't hear anything about Harriet A. Washington saying that she, you know, thinks that there's something wrong with the vaccine, that she's scared of it, that there's some sort of nefarious plot to get black people or do something to them. She did have her skepticism, rightfully so, expressed in the clip that we heard. But I mean, this is the author of Medical Apartheid, which we read, and A Terrible Thing to Waste, and Carte Blanche, and other books that all generally deal with the medical field, racism, white supremacy, many of these books in the very title. So that does give me pause. I'm not exactly running out to sign up for a vaccine, but I mean, that's Harriet, and you can listen for 2 hours. She took questions and all of that. I did not hear the same level of skepticism that I've heard from other folks around the vaccine. In fact, she said something that I've said pretty consistently. It would not surprise me at all if in 10, 15 years, once this is all concluded, the narrative could end up being, oh my gosh, the niggers ran around talking about Nurse Rivers the whole time and they didn't want to get vaccinated and talking about racist boogeymen out to do this and that with the vaccine. And it was, no, not really black people, globally. Globally, black people just didn't have access to the vaccine, whether they were suspicious about it or not. White people greedily hoarded all the vaccines, and that explained what happened with the great Rona strife of 2000, whatever we want to call it, 2021. Man, man, man. Anywho, all of that said, Harriet A. Washington is not a doctor, and I think she did say it's difficult to get information. How much research can one really do? She does a lot of information. I suspect probably way, in fact, I'm willing to say it, if anyone here can prove me wrong, if we have any doctors who listen to the cows step forward or other qualified medical professionals. But until proven otherwise, I think Harriet A. Washington is probably more qualified and has more expertise in that field than anybody listening or participating in this program right now. If that's not true, speak up with your credentials. That said, I thought I'd said this before, but I'll just keep repeating it. I'm not interested in any medical advice from anyone here who is not a medical professional. I feel like that's really irresponsible and reckless right now. If you have a view, you don't want to take the vaccine, fine. Don't take it. Have your suspicions, but we should not be out giving advice as though we are qualified and some sort of medical expert. I don't care what you read. I don't care what you saw. You can just give us the information. Like, here, check this out. This has interest in, leave it at that. I am not. That is repugnant, disgraceful, like heinous, make me gag. Like, I don't want to hear your medical recommendations from some person just hanging out on the street corner. Let me tell you what I read while I was sitting on the toilet for 5 minutes. Who cares? Can't make it no plainer. Still don't like being in that position because it's VGQ and I'm not a medical expert either. But that's why Gus doesn't come on here and give out medical recommendations much further than drink water. Next. Did you all hear the segment where they talked about the highways and white supremacy racism? Read, this is like a whole little plug for no unsolicited medical advice from non-medical professionals and the Cows Book Club. So we got medical apartheid, immortal life of Henrietta Lacks, a terrible thing to waste, and then Katrina after the flood, Gary Rivlin. I narrated that. That was why I was reading the segment where they talked about they used the highway to destroy one of the black enterprising neighborhoods of New Orleans. That was even before we got to Katrina. And I thought it was ironic because they included New Orleans as one of the cities that was successful. Gary Rivlin didn't write about New Orleans as a success story. In fact, he used the word from Sinclair Lewis's book, murder. Metaphor, murder. They used the highway to murder an area with thriving, vibrant black businesses. And they do this strategically, often, if not always, deliberately. That James Lowen, Sundance, I just keep rolling them off from the Cows Book Club. The same type of thing. Another way that we can scatter the Negroes. What does Mr. Fuller say? Keep those squatters on the move. We'll put an interstate right here so we can make it easy so we can get to the mall until we get tired and decide we're just going to Amazon everything. Let's see. The food segment. I got my cookbook. I think I said we had Judith Van Laysen, right? She was on the program just a couple weeks back. We talked about her book, You Are What Your Grandparents Ate. She talked about the importance of food and how that impacts overall health and obesity and so many components of your life and well-being. And I said that she also wrote a cookbook. That cookbook, The Vegetarian Slow Cooker, over 200 delicious recipes. It came in the mail this week. Man, I am excited. Like, I started looking through just to pick out some of the recipes. Like, man. Cannoli with tomato eggplant sauce. This looks so good. I want to make this one. Sweet potato lasagna. I am geeked about anything with sweet potatoes in it. Mixed vegetables in spicy peanut sauce. So many good recipes. Like, there's a French onion dip recipe. Potato and pea coconut curry. That one looks really good. That's on the cover of the book. But this is how, you know, you can pick up easy ways. I don't think too many of these recipes would probably work for the young fellas where we're going to do the luncheon for. But for people who are about some serious eating, who want a full three-course meal or the ability at some point, if you want a three-course meal or come up with other tasty meals and expand your palate, wow, this is how you can have like a full list of really easy things, more complicated things, dessert items, soups, whatever it is. Like, I'm super excited. I'll share more pictures once I cook a few things from her cookbook. But that was my compensatory investment request. See if I can do this again to add some more. So I'll have great this. Then if I want to do my cookbook, it'll be easy because I'll have lots of resources to pick from and make adjustments. All of that, contrast that with what you heard about the food in prisons. Man, they were talking $3 a day for all the meals. And did you hear they said they had some sort of synthetic Kool-Aid that was supposed to have these added nutrients to balance out for all of the gruel and slop that they give them? Like, I'm sitting here looking at, I just told you, the sweet potato pea coconut curry with fresh cilantro and basil and lime juice and fresh garlic in it. It's all spicy and savory. And what do you eat? Oh, I got some gruel, margarine. I haven't had margarine in years. I don't even know what that is. Like margarine. White bread. They said everything on the prison menu is exactly what they tell you not to eat. If you want to be, you want to be dead at 50, eat this here diet. There you go. Get your healthy serving of gruel. Didn't we just heard 2 days ago, Geronimo Press, Total Book Club, Last Man Standing. He just said that. He said with the food, one, he talked about it on Two Measures. It's dominated because he said, I'm having bowel problems. Can't go to the bathroom. They talked about how does it impact your health? Why is white supremacy racism a health issue? Can't go to the bathroom. I'm straining. I'm constipated. So many people suffer from that. Remember, he said he had to take laxatives in prison. Then they didn't even give him the laxatives one time. They switched up and gave him some kind of tranquilizer. Then a racist white supremacist, much like Hitler, comes and tells him, hey, man, put all that pork and salt and meat and gruel down. Just eat leaves, man. Just leaves. Nothing else. And that's prison slang for plants. Just eat plant-based foods. Drink water. Nothing else. He lost 20 pounds and he said it helped out so much. But he said he had to get hooked up from some of the prison trustees to stay on this plant-based prison diet. That did help him tremendously. But that's right in the book that we're reading right now. And Delectable Negro again. Consumption of black people, and then you control their food so you can just sit there and watch them starve, which is another way of kind of psychically consuming them as they whittle away. But you can sit there and they're going to have 4 slices of bread and a glass of water today, and maybe we make it 2 slices of bread and a teaspoon of water. But anybody, if you want to complain about food or whatever, just think about that. I mean, wow, I would absolutely die. I cannot imagine being plant-based now for 3 years and you're going to throw me like a bologna sandwich and some nutrient-fortified Kool-Aid. Talk about Khalif Browder, like gone crazy. The food alone would be enough to do it. Let's see. I guess the final, there are many, many things. The yoga, yoga instructor, so how can I not include that? But we talked about that all throughout teacher training. You heard the segment in Alabama where they have outlawed yoga in schools for the last nearly 3 decades. We talked about some of that in yoga teacher training because so much of that is also related to racism, white supremacy, and a lot of the earlier teachers that came to this area of the world to teach yoga were non-white. And so then it's like, wait a minute, cowbell, you don't want all these non-white people around the white women, and then they're going to encourage having non-white people in the classes and blah 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 and all this other stuff, and this is some other spooky religion where white Jesus is not the head of it. So yeah, lots of reasons we do not want this around 2021, and you still cannot do yoga in school. Embarrassing. And racism and health, something that would be so helpful for breathing and calming students down as opposed to in-school suspension and all the rest of it. Let's do some breathing exercises. Let's do some meditation. Ah, got that spooky voodoo. Get that out of here. The last thing I'll say for right now, the Rwanda segment where they were talking about France being culpable in all of that. That's one where I feel Rwanda should pop up on the book club this year because there are a number of journalists who say that they're one of the contributing factors as to why the greater public does not know more about Rwanda, racism, white supremacy being number one. Number two is that happened 1994. That's going on. one of the big things that happened in 94, Orenthal James, that dominated the news for the next year and a half and continues to some degree. So while people could have been focused on that and doing reports on that, talking about what's happening on the continent, we were talking about Orenthal James. And literally, there are journalists who have said, oh, yeah, that was our attention. Who, you know, cares about what's happening there? Incidentally, in that NPR report on the France's culpability in the Rwandan genocide, they labeled the Rwandan government racist repeatedly. What government do they label as racist? They're sitting here talking about racism as a public health problem. Do they label the United States government as racist as a result of that conclusion? They never do that. They don't even indict Donald Sterling or someone. It doesn't matter what you've done. They never say that. But a black government on the continent in Rwanda, the racist regime. Typical. Words are important. To that end, this broadcast, if we could not use metaphors, that would be super appreciated. Racists regularly employ metaphors to deceive and to have us confused about white supremacy racism. That's master deception. Victims like myself, we've been exposed to this misconduct for years, and many of us, Gusty included, are still learning. Sometimes we don't have all of the logic, evidence to articulate our views, so we switch and substitute a metaphor or analogy, simile, whatever it is. Often this just contributes more confusion. If we could be precise, exact, direct with what we want to say, that would be mega appreciated. I will prompt about the metaphors. Thank you kindly. If you could take about 5 minutes to share your thoughts, observations, questions, that would be great. Just make sure everybody has at least one opportunity to share. If you know you are in a noisy environment, if you could please use your mute button, that would be super appreciated, just so we don't have to compete with a lot of unnecessary background noise. Number again is 720-716-7300, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Folks who are with us, if you have thoughts, observations to share, lines should be open. Proceed.
Can I be heard?
Greetings, Mo in Dallas.
Greetings, Gus. Greetings, listeners and callers. Thank you for the program. I called into the audio segment late, and so I did hear, like, the end of the last segment. And I was kind of taken off guard with the question. The interviewer asked the interviewee, I'm not even sure what the question was, but the answer was very interesting that she gave. The answer of the question, she stated that the first thing that we need to do is name racism and something of that sort, which was confusing to me as a victim of racism, because I thought racism already had a name, and that was racism, white supremacy. It was just like I kind of got jumbled up, and I regret that I called in so late. So, but it was like it seemed like she was avoiding giving a detailed answer to the question, and started focusing on like a part of the question, which was racism. You know, I refer to racism as racism, white supremacy, to be specific. So in her response to his question, when she said racism, the first thing we should do is name racism, I was like, well, what are you calling it if it's not what you're saying? So I was just it took me for a mental loop, and I regret calling in late. Another thing, is in my personal life, my father was
very much unfamiliar with Dr. Francis Cress-Welsing, and I didn't know that. I enjoy Dr. Welsing's work, and you know I've enjoyed it for some time now. And my father, being a 52-year-old male, today is the first time he's ever heard Dr. Welsing speak. He watched a couple of her interviews and a couple of her videos on the internet about systematic white supremacy, and he was just in awe. Like, he was like, I've never heard white supremacy being broken down this way. Like, I finally understand it. And he actually called Dr. Welsing his hero. And that was like, it was like a such a surprisingly, like, it, how do I explain? It was a, I saw, like, I witnessed the switch of understanding go off in his, like, head when it comes to understanding the system of racism, white supremacy. And I'm only bringing that up because I want anyone that hears this program to understand that it is never too late to learn more about the system. And I completely understand why Dr. Fulling uses the statement still learning, because my father is like head first down the rabbit hole on Dr. Welsing. Like, it is awesome. I actually purchased him a copy of the ISIS papers when I found out he was so interested in her. So it should be coming in a couple of days. My last thing, I hope I'm not going on too long. I recently had a car accident, not this Tuesday, but the previous Tuesday. And I was rear-ended. It was a big mess. My car is totaled, and I was disoriented. But I'm still doing my best to practice counter-racist logic, even in this situation. Because this is like, I'm around a new set of non-black white people, you know, that are helping me. You know, the police officer who pulled me out of the car was white, the paramedics were white. And I am mentally logging as well as I can what's going on. And everything seemed smooth all the way up until I actually got into my ER room that was registered to me. And I'm, like I said, I was in a wreck like maybe 15 minutes prior to, and I'm in a hospital bed, and I have to get out and walk myself to the room because I can't be carried or rolled because it's like a bed transfer. And the paramedic, when I get out of the bed and I'm halfway to the room, he says, "Hey, buddy, you left something over here." And like, I'm disoriented. I actually had a concussion. And so I'm walking back to the bed to retrieve whatever I left. And he puts a penny in my hand and says, "Oh, yeah, you might need that." And I was like, "Thank you." And I just walked back to my bed. I couldn't ask him a question because I was in pain and needed to sit down. But it was like, wow, like it really like stuck out to me like that. Like, even in this situation, I am experiencing racism. And I think that's why my guard was up I was so like aware or just paying attention and logging information that I did experience. That's all I have. I'm in my line. Thank you.
Wow. Very sad to hear about your car accident. That's serious, like for the car to be totaled. And we did just have that report last week about it's been more dangerous on the roads and more dangerous for pedestrians, and people have been drag racing. So that is very much in line with the reports for about the last 12 months. But that is horrendous. That idiot has been saying, hunker down, be very mindful if you have to go outside. But all of that said, man, I'm glad that you survived it, and I hope that you are recovering and taking excellent care of yourself. Like, wow, that is super dangerous. And then to get some racist medical apartheid, like, gotta even if you're hobbling on medication, stitched up and everything, still gotta get my racist joke in. A coon is still a coon. So, Dr. Kamara P. Jones, the final segment. The transcript, she was asked by the white man doing the interview, he wanted her to comment on the Biden administration. He said specifically, do you see them just making a statement about making these changes or laying the groundwork for serious different policies about it? So she said in response, I'm very heartened that we, first, you have to make this statement. First, you have to name racism, because if you never name it in our widespread culture of racism denial, then you're complicit with denial. So you have to name a thing, then you have to move to action. And so then he wrapped things up. That's the end of the interview. But my interpretation of what she said, it sounded very much similar to what Dr. Welsing would say about the number one problem, one of the major problems is the denial of racism. So at least to me, it sounded like what she was saying was you have to identify that the problem we're talking about is racism, not trying to skirt around it and this culture of denial. Identifying racism is the problem. I thought that's what she was saying, and I'd say that's pretty logical. We've heard some other folks say that too, but maybe I've just heard. Folks can go to the transcript or rewind to hear what she said. Down the rabbit hole is a metaphor, just watching about that. And Neely Fuller Jr. is not a doctor. I think he said often he has not cured anyone. Let's see. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, proceed.
May I be heard?
Silent Warrior in Norway. Yes, sir.
It's 5:18 here, and I attended the Wilson Institute via Zoom yesterday and or 2 days ago, and that was pretty cool, hosted by Sabrina Johnson, and the theme that we discussed was how to address and resolve intergenerational conflict. And I told a story about how I had, over the Easter holidays, visited a cousin from a side of the family that apparently came to Jamaica from England over 100 years ago to be overseers. And that's where my father's mother comes from. So my father's mother is not doesn't have African heritage. And so I visit this cousin who had moved to Norway after I've been here for a while. And, you know, she had apparently had a tough childhood, but, you know, she had has a child with white male in England, and thinks that the child is white. She might think she passes in Jamaica. She would probably pass for white. In America, I'm pretty sure that wouldn't work. She's like Meghan Markle, I suppose. But the point is that the part of the family that is that mistreats the darker members, and I believe I was being mistreated, so I decided no conflict, and I left or planned to get together for the Easter holiday a few days early, and I spoke to I called my family and told my parents, my mother and my sister, and then I decided, well, you know what, I'll actually reach out to my father and tell him about this and see if this will lead to a conversation about racism. And while I'm describing him the abuse and mistreatment and the things that happened, he started laughing. You know, and I started laughing a little bit as well, but I continued the story, and I asked him, did he experience anything like this with this cousin's, the second cousin's mother, which was his cousin? And he said, yeah. When they were growing up in the countryside, you know, they also, this this cousin had a difficult childhood, but they were getting off on this concept that they were white or white passing. And I asked him, did his mother, who was also white or white passing, did his mother ever talk to him about racism, warn about how to protect himself? Because I know that later in his life he experienced racism at work. And most likely when he went to study in the United States. And he said, no. It was never brought up, and that was the right thing to do. Right thing, never to bring up racism. But he did say that these cousins were racist. And he did agree that you probably experienced racism, Eton. So that was... That seemed to be quite constructive. I got a little bit of the family genealogy. 18. So I think that is. Do I have any more time, or is that, or can I come back later?
You have about 60 seconds. If you can get in about a minute.
Cool. I decoded Little Nas X's lyric. His lyric is "Call Me by Your Name," and we discussed it in the Wilson Institute. And it's the decode is "I may not have much self-respect, so you can call me by your name / or the name you give me." And the song lyric recalls enslaved Africans being forced to take the name given by racist slave owners, as made well known in the Roots series. Some solutions can be that was discussed, that in general victims of racism can do, that was pushed forward by Dr. Wilson, is to do mirror work. Stand in front of a mirror, look at yourself and say, I love and respect myself unconditionally. I love and respect Black people. And doing this, doing things like this can help to build your self-respect. Self-respect builds courage, and increased courage helps to deal with the fear of tackling racism, white supremacy. Thank you for the time.
Black brother, hell.
Much obliged, silent warrior. Denial. Not just say that. Dr. Wilson used to talk about that all the time, the denial of racism. That's what resonated with me when Dr. Kamara P. Jones, when she was giving her final commentary, we have to call things by their proper name. We have to name what problem we are trying to solve here, that problem being racism, white supremacy. Have it come up again talking with family members, which is very common where lots of folks are just in denial. Avoid talking about white supremacy, racism, and how much of a trauma problem it has been in their life that is widespread worldwide. Incidentally, just because I know people get very excited, no Area 8 on the compensatory call-in, interracial so-called intercourse, always a very popular topic. No Area 8 and no entertainment on the compensatory call-in. Both of those kind of intertwined frequently. Other folks who have we've not heard from, if you have commentary to share, line should be open. Proceed.
Hello.
Irie in Louisiana. Yes, ma'am.
Yeah. The area that I didn't catch any of the highlights, but I heard you talking about it. I was with my grandmother when I was about maybe 12 or 13, and she told me that that area, uptown, I believe, is called, was called the street that went through the business district of Black people. It's called Aretha Castle Haley. And since gentrification, they've changed it to something else, but I still know it as that. And she told me that it was where the Black people, she said this was the Black people's Canal Street. And if you know some about New Orleans, New Orleans has the street that goes whatever direction it is, runs from the river, the mouth of the river, away into Jefferson Parish, but they call it something else by that time. I can't remember what it's called because I don't even go over there anymore. Yeah, it's a shame. And after the storm, I had purchased my first home in that area, actually, and it had some damage. And I remember some white people calling me and offering me like $1,000 for my house. I'm sorry. I'm just laughing again. Same situation like last week I had called in, but it's different. And I'm just not going to be able to teach anymore. I have to teach on my own terms because I was injured by a student, and it wasn't necessarily his fault. He's a special education student, and I ended up in his class because a white lady wanted to get off of work early, and she got out by practicing deceit. She told me that she wanted me to switch roles with her because she, quote, knew the curriculum, which is very vague if you ask me, and I'm sure some of y'all would agree. She was like, well, since I know the curriculum, I'm just going to teach the class and you'll just do what I do for the day. And I asked her immediately, did the teacher not leave plans? Like, what's going on? And why do I have to, like, it just doesn't make sense. Like, if there are plans, why do I have to switch? It's like any other sub job, you know? I just follow the plans. And she's like, I know it'll just be easier that way. But I didn't know that my day was going to be half of a day and end at 11. So because she knew that and I didn't, she got to leave early and I had to take her role. And then, you know, anybody that teaches special education students knows the younger they are, especially sometimes, and even the older they are, it depends on the disability, when there's a change in their schedule, It can send them off emotionally. So the student basically kicked me in my knee moderately. He didn't do it like, you know, with all his might. And I'm glad because he's an obese student. He's probably 140 pounds and he's only 8 years old. You know what I'm saying? So if he would have gave me everything he had, yeah, I would have been severely injured. And I already hurt this knee being in the military. So I'm like, I can't teach anymore. I'm out of it, you know. And then when I got to the hospital, I needed to use the bathroom and I couldn't walk. So I told the nurse's aide, I need to use the restroom. So the white female nurse overheard this and said, okay, that's good because we're going to need a urine sample anyway. I said, why do you need a urine sample? I'm here because my knee is hurt. I'm not having surgery. I'm not, what are you doing it for? Well, you're not going to get any pain medication until you do a urine sample. I said, okay. I said, I will write something down, attesting to, oh no, she said she needed it because she needed to verify I wasn't pregnant. I said, I will attest to that in writing, but you're not getting any unnecessary specimens from me. It's not happening. And so when I got to the bathroom, the non-white Asian nurse's aide tried to give me a cup, and I politely told her, please do not give it to me. I will not be filling it up. And then the last thing I want to report, in a different part of the South, in Alabama, I have a sick relative in ICU on life support. So I was talking to my oldest little sister, and she was like, Irie, there's something weird going on. She was like, you and I both know this relative is not a productive citizen, you know, according to white people's standards. She hasn't come to, you know, being able to say that yet, but I know that, and she kind of knows it too. This person is, you know, disabled and all this other stuff, like mute and deaf. So she was like, I was sitting in the room, and there was a plexiglass container on the wall. And it had a vial inside, and the plexiglass container was unsecured. It was unlocked. So she asked the nurse, white female again, what is that medicine over there? And she replies, oh, it's just the Michael Jackson drug. And I said, to her, do you know what that is? Do you remember what that is? And she's like, yeah, man. Like, she was like, well, if I didn't, I knew enough to know that's what killed Michael Jackson. So I asked her, why do you have it in here with my relative unlocked? Why is it even in here? And so that's when the lady came back and put a lock on the container, but didn't remove it. So I basically concluded, I could be incorrect, but I think I'm smart. They may be trying to euthanize my family member on slickly. Well, that's a metaphor, but quietly and covertly commit murder. Commit murder. Because, again, this lady's on life support, and the relative in charge of her guardian, to me, I believe, is capitalizing off of death in the family, one of which was my father, actually, because my father was diabetic. He died before he should, in my opinion. And ultimately, he needed some amputations, transplants, and then one day at home by himself, his heart stopped, and they didn't find him in time. And then her son also passed away from kidney failure. He was put on life support. My dad was put on life support, and now basically her sister is on life support. And now there's propofol in her room, you know, just out there. I'm sorry, y'all. I'd be trying not to get emotional, but like, I'm glad that the program is here so I can get feedback and just let it out, because my friends and family members, I try telling them about the code. They don't want to listen. They're not listening to the code. They're not trying to hear Mr. Fuller. They're not trying to hear Dr. Francis. They're not trying to hear nothing. Nothing at all. And I'm like, I feel like I'm, you know, isolated because of that. And then me going through what I go through, I just get so angry, because this does not have to be. It just doesn't have to be. And I'm just, thank you, Gus, for letting me share. And thank you for everyone on the line. Hotep.
Much obliged, Iri. Self-care, really important. I think many of us have been super stressed over the last year plus, and you know, it's many, many things for us to be stressed about, but just making time for ourselves, make sure we can get quality rest and do some things that are nourishing for us, because it's been a very exhausting year plus. All of that said, black self-respect in saying no. That, in fact, that's what Harriet A. Washington's Carte Blanche, I haven't read it yet, but I think that's what it relates to, consent, and talking about the many different ways that medical institutions manipulate consent and get around that. So just being able to say no, like, I'm here because of my knee. You don't need a urine sample. No, thank you kindly. And they do the same thing. They'll send the victim over. Come on, just a little urine, just a teaspoon. I'm good, thank you. And then to have a relative, and Vernelia Randall, she talked to us about this, just being an advocate. You don't have to have a PhD in science or anything else. Just, I'm here, I'm an observant, I'm asking questions. What's that? Why is it here? Is that medication supposed to be here? Is it supposed to be secured? Just being observant, asking questions. As I think Mo in Dallas and other folks said, if you're not feeling well, you're not really going to be, you know, in your best frame of mind to practice counter-racism and ask questions and be vigilant about everything that's happening around you. That's just having someone who's healthy, who can do that for you, ask questions and advocate in your best interest. That can be such an enormous act of counter-racism, where you can be so effective just asking questions. You don't have to stomp up and down or have a firearm, just asking questions, being observant, seeing that they answer my question in a way that I can understand it, can have a huge impact. So bravo for that. It has been extremely stressful, and just the black self-respect also, I guess, not just saying no to the medical staff, but also in terms of saying, hey, I'm not going to subject myself to this. Teaching conditions will have to be where I feel safe. And, you know, they're looking out for my best interests as an educator. And I'm in an environment where I can do something, do some quality educating for these students. But yeah, I'm sorry you had to experience that with this young person, young victim. And man, talking about food, she said 8 years old, 140 pounds. Wow. Now, I don't know if, you know, some of that is related to the Rona. They just had a report this week. I think we had one last week talking about how much weight children have gained over the past year being out of school and all the rest of it. But I mean, that is no kind of way healthy body weight. 8 years old, 140 pounds. I mean, unless we're talking somebody who's like, you know, maybe 5'11". I mean, if we're talking a 8 year old that's 5'11 and 140, like, ooh, we can we get him some sort of sports? Well, never mind. Then we're back to the CTE. You are what your grandparents ate. Food is very, very important. And as Judith Finlayson said, we are in an obesogenic environment where white people work to create tragic situations just like that. I think she even mentioned her father having a lot of medical issues and amputations and diabetes. A lot of that obesogenic, racist environment that is designed to totally impair the health and well-being of black people. Let's see. Other folks that we have missed totally. If you have a hand up, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Greetings, retired firefighter in Florida.
Greetings, Gus. Did you pronounce the name Najee Davenport?
Thought it was Ahmad Green, but yes, I mixed up my running backs for the Green Bay Packers, mixing up black people.
Oh, okay.
Najee Davenport, yes, Najee Davenport, not Ahmad.
Right,
they did
right.
Both play for the Packers, though, yes.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's the ex NFL player that I know. He had a some kind of lawsuit out involving concussion, and it is suspected that he may have CTE. You want to try to set up an interview with him?
If he'd be willing to talk to us, we will behave.
Well, the challenge is me getting in touch with him. I don't have any number or anything, but I'll see if I can call some of my coaching connections and from there maybe I can get in touch with him and then connect him with you. In that particular fashion, that's how I would go about the means of trying to get that done. I'll give it a try. I'll give it a try. I haven't even seen him in years. Anyway, you had a story on the different reports, and it reminded me of the building of I-95 through a nationally known area in South Florida that was called Overtown. And that was during my early childhood. I can recall. I don't remember exactly because I didn't stay in the area about the construction of this interstate through that area, but I do recall the difference in how my attempted dad used to take his three sons to work with him at his barbershop. And we had to change our route because of the construction. And then as time went by, I began to learn about the racist issue part of that type of decisions that are made by white people practicing racism, white supremacy, not only in that area, but it's been significant places all over this part of the world in that fashion. And Overtown, what was called Overtown, just happened to have been one of them. You name the black entertainer and or political official of a black person that you may have studied and read in history books. If they came to South Florida, they stayed somewhere in Overtown, in the hotels that was available to them, and not on Miami Beach at the time. As I mentioned before, you had to have a passport as a black person to go to Miami Beach during those times. But that person stayed in Overtown, including the greatest of all time, Muhammad Ali. When he first came to South Florida, he stayed in an apartment in Overtown before he bought his own house. So, that report reminded me of the incident taking place in South Florida. And that's all I have to say. Thank you. I'll get on that, and if I get something, I'll contact you.
Much obliged, good sir, Mr. Davenport. Yes, we will look forward to hearing from him. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, you have commentary to share. Line should be open. Proceed.
Can I be heard?
Emmy in the DMV. Namaste.
Namaste, Adam, guys. Greetings, beautiful people. I had a lot that I wanted to say, but the first thing is, could the caller from, I think it's the Netherlands, could he please share the Zoom information, like login information, date, time, and like their code and their passcode for the Welding Institute? I did not even know that was still going on and going on via Zoom. So for me, that's very actually frustrating because, and so I'll say this, because as soon as I heard that, I jumped on the internet and typed in Welding Institute, the Welding Institute, Francis Crest Welding Institute, like as many like keywords as I could. And I could not find, number one, just a website. So I could be totally wrong. Let me say that. I could be wrong. Maybe I spelled something wrong. Maybe it's there and it's under some other name that I can't find or whatever. And it's all my fault because, you know, I'm still learning. So I'll put that out there. But the fact that I couldn't find it is very frustrating. It burned me so much that it's so hard to find Dr. Welding's work. All the work that she did, it's very difficult to find it, to find the recordings of her speaking, to find this Zoom link. Like, what are you talking about? Even when I clicked on like a Facebook thing, I don't even have Facebook, so I had to hurry up and like try to work around getting into it to find it. There's nothing that's like Zoom link meeting still going on. Sabrina Johnson, Dr. Crest Welding, so many people can attend because it's Zoom now and not physical. What is that? You know, I don't know what is going on around her work where it's hidden, secluded, sequestered, and like super difficult to access. I had to get that out. So please, caller from the Netherlands, I think you are, if you could please jump back on here so I can scribble it down, I'd be very, very, very grateful to you. This is not workplace racism, but I just wanted to say it because I think it's just pertinent, and I'll probably call in on workplace racism to say it again. So I'm getting ready to go to school. So I was like, you know, let me try and get my bag up, make as much money, excuse the metaphor, make as much money as I can before that happens. Thankfully, someone left on the other end of the week, so I was able to pick up all these shifts, and I chose to do that. I know about that. So I'm currently working 6 days a week, 6 nights a week, excuse me, 10-hour shift. And I only have Monday nights off. So today I get a text message where the racist white female manager asked me, and I know it's not a suspect. She's not a suspect. Asked me to come in earlier. I just responded, no, period. Then the racist suspect white male manager asked me to stay late tomorrow, in which case I wrote like an entire paragraph about, no, I'm not doing that 6 days a week. Everything I just told you, and I'm having difficulty sleeping. And he's okay, no problem. And I just think that that's so fascinating that you, not fascinating, but just highlights how white people see us. For me, at this moment, you know what I mean? Workhorse, excuse the metaphor, just, you know, a slave. And that is not a metaphor. I'm using that in just the way I'm using it. How can you ask someone working 6 days a week overtime to come in earlier and stay later for some nonsense that I, like, what are you talking about? Moving on. And then for one question that I've been noticing as I listen in, because there was a lot to say, like, what, that's what white people do, practice racism, like, in every form or fashion, you know, in every way, you know? So I could talk about that forever. But one question that I'm noticing that these interviewers are asking, these, I'm assuming, I think they're white for the most part, they're white, interviewers are asking non-white people about whatever topic is happening, could be any topic, is, well, do you think the reason that white people are doing it is just because they're black? It's like some form of that question. And I don't know why I find that question very irritating, because maybe because I think it's so obvious, and I think it's, and maybe it's not. Maybe this is just me being insensitive to the average viewer, maybe a viewer or a listener who's not participating in the cows. But if we're talking about racism, how are you going to ask me, why do I think that the reason that these white people are doing whatever they're doing is because, to the black people, is because they're black? I don't understand that. You know what I mean? It's like a circular question that doesn't ever get the conversation anywhere. You know, it just, it doesn't. It just, it doesn't. And I find that question to be disrespectful, quite frankly. And then there was, I thought the interviewer was practicing racism when the woman called in about her grandson. And he brought the white woman in, not the interviewer, I'm assuming she's a white woman, who was talking about the gruel that they have to eat in prison. And the way that she was like, well, yeah, if you leave your information with the, what you call it, we'll get caught in contact with you. You know, I just felt like the likelihood of that happening is so slim. And I felt like she was practicing racism, because I don't know where the woman that called in from, but presumably she could be non-white. I don't know how right whites would classify her, but she could be non-white. And I felt like you want to do this work, but you don't have, like, you didn't give her, the woman, your email. Like, I mean, I'm sure you have an email where you do receive lots of correspondence that's not a personal email that you could, like, shift through that. The likelihood of that woman getting in contact or finding any resolve for that was super slim, and I just felt like that was a way that that white woman practiced racism. If she is white, I could be incorrect. But with that, I will leave it. So thank you all for listening. Please, again, caller, if you could please get back on here real quick before we end and give me the Zoom stuff, I'd be super grateful to you. Thanks.
Much obliged. Emmy in the DMV area. I think that's a part of racism, white supremacy, where sometimes either, whether it's books or just constructive content, sometimes it can be difficult to access deliberately. So sometimes, and sometimes because of the system of racism, white supremacy, victims aren't able to do as much in letting people know and getting the information out as wide as possible, where they have lots of obstacles in that process. I certainly can relate to that over the years with the cows. But I do know, having chatted up with Sabrina, she was in D.C. for the yoga retreat. I shared the link with some of the folks who were at the yoga retreat and on the cows when she said that she was going to be continuing the Welsing Institute at the time. It was the autumn of 2020. And I know I mentioned it on the program because I emailed it to some other folks. I don't myself know of a website. Let's see, Silent Warrior in Norway. Do you have, is it like a, link. Oh, and I can say Sabrina Johnson, I talked to her directly. It is racism, white supremacy, because she even said she was going to come back on the program when we spoke at the retreat. She was going to come on the program. We were going to talk about continuing the Welsing Institute, and she had talked about some of the other things that they were talking about, because there were so many incidents of white people being terrorists and attacking people in public. Like, it was a whole conversation around that. But she said after we both got back and months after the retreat, racism, white supremacy, I think workplace racism specifically, but that caused lots of disruption, so we weren't able to touch base as often as we wanted to exchange information. But yeah, I thought direct racism and why some of that isn't greater promotion and why it isn't easier to disseminate that information. Caller in Norway, did you have a link or where folks can go?
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, sir.
Hello?
We can hear you. Yes, sir.
Great. Yes. So, first, I'd like to say thank you to Christine Williams and 0526. They're the ones that have made me aware of this Welsing Institute link on Zoom. I've been to it happens every 2 weeks. And the best way I could give you an email address that you could contact me on, or I could really suggest that, and I will also suggest that you join a Facebook group that I've created called the Dr. Francis Cress Welsing and Neela Fuller Facebook group. It's a moderated group, so there aren't any posts that are allowed in the group that don't refer directly to the work or content of Dr. Francis Welsing or Neela Fuller. And you have to give a definition of racism and agree to codified rules in order to be admitted to the group. Email address 127464@usn.no. I'll say it again. 27464@usn.no. You can shoot me an email there and I can hook you up if you don't want to get on Facebook. I'd also like to give a shout out to the Countering Racism White Supremacy Book Club. They've been doing Zoom meetings of like under 10 people, and it's really constructive. They have been doing 0526 has been doing about 3 or 4 books a week, where they take 12 pages per book, and the meeting on Zoom lasts for about 2 hours, and we get to discuss the book, analyze it with respect to racism. Right now we're doing a book called The Body Keeps the Score, about how to deal with trauma. It's got lots of good information, and we apply our analysis of racism to it. And their next meeting is on Monday. And if anyone gets at me at that email address, I'll give them the hookup. And they can search on Facebook, Dr. Francis Cress Welsing and Neela Fuller Study Group. But you have to give out your own definition of racism, and you have to agree to the codified rules. 127464@usn.no. And before going, I'd like to say thank you to Gus, because the cows is how we are all been able to keep connected. So let's also be grateful for the resource that has been very consistent. Thank you.
Much obliged, caller in Norway. Constructive info, still the same. You like the cows, so what? Don't like the cows, so what? Replace white supremacy with justice. Folks that we missed totally as we wrap up.
May I be heard?
Caller in Florida. Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much, sir. Greetings to Gus, the host, the listeners and callers. I was also thinking about that segment where they were talking about the unhealthy prison food, and like the way she was describing the type of food, I think that her grandson was being fed. I don't know if she said it was some kind of eggs or something, or it just seemed like it was repulsive. And, you know, I was thinking about how that description was. And another thing I was thinking about was, that's where you mentioned the former football player. There was that news story about the shooting occurring. And I noticed one thing where the comparisons, where it was two shootings that happened at the same time, I think on that same day, where it was one in Texas, I think. And I noticed the differences where when they do the report, they'll have the dispatcher voice describing the suspect. So, of course, the black male, black clothing description was displayed and played and everything. But I noticed the one in Texas, they just said, well, we're just waiting for all of the details. We're waiting for everything to come out and everything. And it took like maybe a day or two before they even showed the image of the white guy that did the shooting, you know. So that was just one thing I wanted to make a mention of, the comparisons between the two reported shooting. And that's all I have to share. Thanks for allowing me to speak.
Significant contrast, sir. Much obliged. I don't know if folks remember, there have been so many shootings, it's hard to process all the different events and what have you. But in Colorado, so they had the shooting not that long ago in Colorado. I think that was the one we said it, kind of a racially ambiguous person, but I think most of us thought it was someone classified as white, where they said at first they were all, you know, upset. Gun legislation and all of that. And so they waited, had shootings in other places, took the attention away from Colorado. Now they said, we're all right. We don't really need any new gun legislation. Like, I thought y'all were just talking about Aurora and Columbine and all this has got to stop. Get to it. Talked about that before. No gun legislation on the horizon. Didn't expect that to change this time. Let's see. Anybody that we missed totally as we wrap up? We did our 3 hours.
May I be heard?
Mr. Blue? Yes, sir.
Greetings, Gus. Greetings to all the callers. First thing, I'll make things quick. Maria, I'll have to go. Gus, my apologies if I think prior last week's compensatory call-in, I hope it wasn't me, but I may have talked about my sister and vaccine primers and catalysts, and I do not want to seem like I know anything because I'm not a medical doctor, and if I said misspoke or gave any misinformation, sometimes I'm overzealous about information I may get and want to share it, my definite apologies, because this program has been very constructive to me and the very few people and friends that do listen in. So my apologies if that was me, if you were talking about people who are giving medical advice who are not medical doctors. My apologies to you and the guest if I am in fact that person. I was the protesting and the possible ban on protesting, or not ban, but protesters being charged with felonies for looting and robbing. I've been listening to past episodes in the archives with Shahrazad Ali, and also a recent one with Dr. Frances Cress-Welsing, where she's talking about the Michael Brown case and non-white black people and non-white people, but non-white black people in specific, protesting and how that should be a practice that we need to give up and actually get to the business of stating exactly the system that we are in and things like, if something happens in the community, do not go out protesting, but instead we as a community of non-white black people who understand we are in a system of racism, white supremacy, that we do not spend money during Christmas. We do not spend money on Thanksgiving. We do not spend money on holidays until those injustices, murders, and whatnot, and terrorism against the black community have been solved, because we all understand this is a system of racism, white supremacy. And I agree wholeheartedly with her sentiments and with what she said. And that that archive was, I listened to it multiple times. It's always informative listening to Dr. Frances Cress-Welsing and her exactness and her clarity on the system of racism, white supremacy. And about the listening to Harriet Washington talk about the mask and, you know, COVID in the African-American communities and things like that. I think when she said something about masks being possibly that the government should make mandates that enforce mask wearing, because people may be in supermarkets and things like that and not wearing their mask and refusing to wear a mask. I don't know how I may feel about that, because just that people classify themselves as white, enforcing things always to me seems like it could lead to further enforcements, sort of like enforcements that you have to get a vaccination if you're going to work. And I'm looking for work as an assistant professor or adjunct professor in universities, community colleges across the country, and to be forced to get a vaccine so that I could get employment would really make things even more difficult than they already are. And there was just an incident with the director of a residency program I'm supposed to go into, this week. And she got her first dose last week, 2 weeks ago, and she started to suffer from loss of appetite. Eventually, she had to go into the hospital, and they told her that she had pneumonia and she'd also contracted COVID. And so it's just, I'm always just suspicious of anything that's enforced, especially on the so-called black community. And I'll mute my line. And thank you, Gus. Thank you to all of you. Always constructive. And I'll mute my line.
Much obliged, Mr. Blue. No apologies needed, because it has been widespread. Lots of folks who are not doctors have, you know, been excited or anxious or stressed or whatever it is, but that has been widespread over the last year or so, just striving for vetting info. That said, we did our 3 hours, and I think we nabbed everybody this time around. So we will be here on Tuesday. Chip Jones, lots of reasons. That would be another book talking about being suspicious of the vaccine and how it's going to be enforced. Logical reasons to be suspicious on all accounts. Mr. Jones' book would be another reason to be suspicious about all of this. The Organ Thieves. I think it just came out. I'm going to be reading it or finishing it up. But I think this is like a newer book came out last few months or so. White man, white author, white guests only. He'll be here Tuesday, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. We can pose some of these questions to him. Much obliged for the folks who tuned in. Hope it was worthy of your Saturday evening or Sunday morning, I reckon. Our caller in Norway. Sobriety with the best under conditions of white supremacy. We need a full brain computer to solve this problem. In addition to being sober, like, man, Mo in Dallas thought about almost being killed. Vehicle accident, like, man, all of the zaniness that is happening in the world right now. If you have to go out, you should be super aware of what's happening around you. If it's anybody being rowdy, yelling, get away. Like, maximum distance. Like, get away. This is no time for verbal confrontations with strangers out in public. You have no idea if they're armed, if they're with a whole cadre of people who are also armed. Like, get away. If you need to get any information so you can make a report and what have you, do that as you are fleeing the scene, exiting the scene, I'll say. But if you didn't leave your residence prepared for mortal combat, exit. You do not want to take a chance and find out, oh, wow, this is, you know, old Stephen Paddock with 50 rounds of ammunition and all the rest in the trunk. That said, we are sober, hunkering down, but if you go out, you are buckled. If you are driving, you are not on the cell phone. We need all of our attention, being vigilant, and we're trying to avoid contact with the Derek Chauvin, Mark Furmans of the known universe. With that, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. There was an audio segment I did not intend to play because it was published just before we went live, but it was at the very beginning about suicide rates increasing for black people over the last year. Would have enjoyed hearing Dr. Welsing's thoughts on that. We do not qualify for mental health, but wow. Self-care is super important for so many reasons. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, brother.
No problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning.
Mm-hmm.
Even my conditioning has been conditioned.